I am God, your best alive. I've been waiting for you. Now I'm going to start.
Morning, everybody. Dad, I want to apologize for this inconvenience in terms of delaying times. Because there's a meeting that is starting at 8:30, where myself and the chairperson of the caucus, who's a member of the committee, is supposed to attend. We've been trying to talk to them so that this meeting does not take place. Maybe takes place earlier or later, but we are not succeeding. Nevertheless, we're here. She'll be joining us soon. The purpose of the meeting is for us to hear from the department as to what is that they will be doing in terms of responses to the State of the Nation address. The State of the Nation address is derived from the January 8th statement of the ruling party. Most of the things that appeared in the State of the Nation address are the things that appeared in the January 8th as the priorities of government for this year. I do know that the minister will have to, he will be saying some other things when he is doing his budget vote. So we are aware, I am aware, I think the members should be aware, until such time the budget vote of Dole, you might not be able to go into details and preempting what the minister is going to say. But of course, you are the people who are implementing what the minister is going to be saying and what we are expecting as members. I'm sure you did not fold your arms and wait for the minister to say this is the direction. Some of the things are things that have been outstanding. For instance, the question of decent jobs. That's what we should be looking at, something that is in the State of the Nation address and the January 8th statement of the ANC. But it's something that is linked to inspectorate as well. Because though people, whenever there is something that is said about jobs, the person who will appear on the screen is the Minister of Labour. The impression is that the Minister of Labour or the Dole or Department of Labour is the one that is supposed to be creating jobs. I think that's what people know out there. Until such time, we go out and talk and make people to understand what is the role of this department as to oppose to creation of jobs. What is its role? So I'm sure you will be telling us, what is that you have done in the past few months in making a point that your soldiers who have to be in the doorsteps of the companies and check the status of the conditions in which the workers are working in. Because you can't talk about this, and when you talk about decent jobs, you talk about decent jobs, but the Department of Labor should be the one who's saying we are satisfied that the conditions under which workers are working in a certain companies is correct. If you don't do that, nobody will do it. All they will do is to give jobs. Whether the jobs are quantity or what, that depends on the Department of Labor to see whether the workers, really what is there is what we refer to as decent jobs and decent work. With those a few words, I welcome everybody who is here. We have a very a difficult task in this year. The president has been under a serious attack for a number of things. And this department will have to choose to check what is that they have to do. All this, you listened to the State of the Nation address, you listened to the debate of the president, you heard the attacks. It's not criticism, it was attacks, correctly or right on certain issues, but it is us who is failing the president in certain aspects. So the Department of Labor has a responsibility that to come the next State of the Nation address, all the promises that have been made by the president that are related to the Department of Labor will be 100% right. We have to aim for 100% so that we fall at least to 80%. If we aim for 40%, we will not begin. So myself and the committee, we want to give you all the support that you need, and we won't have much time in Parliament. We'll spend much of the time, we're going to rearrange our program. We'll have most of the time going to see whether the things that U.S. Department have to implement are being implemented. So we want to tell you from the beginning that next year, the State of the Nation address, the DOL, the responsibilities that are supposed to be done by DOL will be 100% right. In all respects, everything, all the departments of the Department of Labor will have to work 24 hours if it means they have to work 24 hours. I don't know if the members want to say something before I give the Department of Labor a chance to say something to us. Anybody from the members? Over to you, members of the department.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for a couple of things. Firstly, for your sensitivity to the fact that we are also ahead of the budget speech of the minister, and that all we can say here today is largely a high-level kind of presentation up until the minister has spoken, and then we can go to the nitty-gritty. So I really appreciate that kind of understanding. I must also just say apologize for the fact that we have issued a draft, but because we're trying to keep honorable members sort of informed, we issued the draft even before, I think, the State of the Nation address, with the view that after the State of the Nation address, we'll make some few tweaks and so on. So I would appeal to members to focus largely on the presentation on the screen. That is the latest version. We gave that information that you have there just so you get a sense of what we're going to be talking about. But the actual details, the actual final presentation is what is on the screen. I don't know if you have copies of what is on the screen, but that is actually the final version. There was a prior copy that was sent earlier on. And Chair, I'm joined here by the top team of the department. So everyone that is an executive manager, or that's a wrong language, everywhere that is at that level, just below the DG level, is here. All the direct reports are here. So all the top team is right here. Regulatory department are all here. So if there's anything that requires further probing, I think I have all the people here that can assist me with that. Okay. I think this is the outline of the presentation, Chair. We'll make some introductory comments, and then we'll talk to the State of the Nation address and priorities for the forthcoming financial year, and then also how the department is going to contribute on the government priorities for the next coming financial year. Okay, this is just a point that we just make in passing, Chair, that we know that on the 17th of February there's going to be this budget speech and so on, and then that would include the our department's vote, and that really, once that is done, then the details of what we've already submitted for the E&E can actually happen actually after that date. We also want to put on the table, Chair, that on the 2nd of March, which is the official date, that the department will be presenting its strategic plan on that date. So that is in schedule and it is on time. I think some of our inputs, Chair, will be contained in various other committees because we participate, I think, in about four or so cluster committees where our input is made, whether it's a social cluster, GNA, economic cluster, and so on. Okay, then finally, as point was made here, that the budget speech of the minister really should be the one that sets the tone for us. But right now, we'll give you just a flavor of what the department is about. I think, Chair, as you correctly point out, we also thought, let's just make this point very clear, that the purpose of the department is really to regulate the labor market. We really want to make this clear. We'll communicate this much more, Chair, that our role is really to regulate the labor market, which presupposes that we must first of all have the labor market, and then we only come in to regulate. We don't create jobs per se, but jobs that get created are sort of a byproduct. But our role is to go into a labor market and regulate. We assist the integration of the unemployed into the labor market. We continue to do that. We also enforce all labor legislation. These are the tools that we use to ensure that the labor market is properly regulated, that the laws are enforced. We will talk to you about what we're going to do in terms of ensuring that indeed these things happen. We'll talk to you about how we're going to integrate the unemployed into the labor market. We'll talk about what are we putting into place to ensure that the laws are enforced. We'll also talk about what is it that we're doing for the protection of the unemployed and the injured people at work. So these are the tools that we use in the department to execute our work. Chair, just to show you the scope of our involvement, we're a national department, as I'm sure this committee would know. We have about 125 labor centers across the country. In remote areas, we have 20 mobile units so that we can go get to Kobo and all these other remote areas. We've got mobile units that we have. We also have, we participate in the Tusong centers. Out of the 139 Tusong centers, were operational in 72 of those Tusong centers, where there's limited IT capability, but we're able to ensure that assist the people there. The presentation that today will probably have a different number, but this is the number that is the updated number, the 72. So what you have in your presentation is not the right number. This is the right number. And then, Chair, just to make sure that we're aligned to government priorities. Government has got five priorities. And clearly, because we can't be everything to everyone, for us, the two priorities around the health and jobs are the two ones that this department has got levers to engage within those priorities. And on the health side, we've got the Occupational Health and Safety Act, and we've got the OCOIDA. That is a tool that we use to engage on that for people that get injured at work and so on. And then on the job market, We've got a raft of policy instruments to assist us with that. The others, it's very partial involvement for us. I think also, Chair, just to make a point, that even if you look at the 12 government outcomes that are out there, four of those outcomes are what relate to what we do as a department. So I've listed the outcomes that are there, and we participate through those clusters that deal with those outcomes. So that's really just to make sure that what we do is aligned to government priority, is aligned also to the 12 government outcomes. This is just a slide, Chair, just to show you how we are structured as we speak as a department, that we obviously have the administration office with those various departments that are out there. We have an inspection and enforcement services to ensure that there's compliance with standards, there's inspections, there's enforcement, there's prosecution. We're sitting with something like 1,000 or so labor inspectors, and we'll talk to that just now, to carry out that function. Public Employment Service, that division is getting much more pronouncement now following the State President's proclamation to remove the skills from the Department of Labor. We've now firmed up what Public Employment Service should do, and we'll talk to that as well. Unemployment Insurance Fund and Compensation Fund, we've spoken to that. It's provision of interim relief for income in case of job loss or occupational injuries and diseases. Labor policy and labor market programs. We'll talk. So, Chair, I think this actually will frame our presentation. We'll just bullet point that under each one of these headings, what is it that we're going to do, just so that you get a flavor of our activities for the forthcoming year. If we look at public employment service, which talks to the reduction of unemployment by placing people in decent work and contributing to inclusive economic growth, what is it that we're going to do? We are busy right now, Chair, with a bill which we are confident that by the end of the financial year, March 2011, it's just that we are not in control of the parliamentary processes. So for us, sitting where we sit, we're not able to give a definite date because we don't understand the schedules of when is Parliament going to do what, whatever. But we know that from our side, we'll do everything to ensure that by the end of the financial year, would be over and about in terms of the public employment service. Also, Chair, we will continue to be involved in the training layoff. That's a very important element, Chair, that talks to the issue of jobs. What that training layoff does, as members would know, probably have read extensively in the media, we ensure that instead of people getting retrenched, we bargain with employers to say, don't retrench the people. We'll help you subsidize their salaries by 50%. We will also help to have the people retrained at our cost. And to that extent, the department has put out this $2.4 billion. Now, there's been challenges in terms of the uptake of that scheme. And one of the challenges, Chair, it's been multi-pronged. One of the challenges around that has been that sometimes employees themselves, when they see the kinds of payouts that they would get, they sometimes prefer to take the payout than continue with the job. So we have that challenge, number one. And we've been calling upon labor to try and counsel employees and make employees understand that what looks like a lot of money, maybe 100,000 or so, that somebody might get, is actually, in real terms, would go out very quickly. But people mustn't think that if you've never run a business in your life, that all of a sudden, now that you have 100,000, that you think you can start a business. So that's a temptation that we think is happening on the one level. But I think also for us, even from our bureaucracy, Chair, We do have some cleanup to do. We need to streamline and make sure that our decision-making process is fast. So I don't think we're completely innocent in terms of our own administration of the scheme. So it's something that we're looking at to ensure that the bureaucracy is really curtailed. Because I think we also have a stigma generally as government that we're too slow with everything. So I think that stigma carries on. Employees are just fatigued to have to deal with government in terms of them participating in the scheme. But we're trying to clean up our act there as well from our side. So I think there's no one particular party that is to blame here, but I think all of us need to do something to ensure that that layoff really takes off share. We also have issued $2 billion to the IDC for distressed companies, again, there to ensure that we assist in this economy to make sure that companies don't fold. So I think as this department, we have done our bit to ensure that we are a part of the solution in this job crisis situation. What we plan to do, Chair, is to have a multi-purpose portal that we want to have this year. This multi-purpose portal is going to be IT-driven. It's going to be a one-stop kind of situation where we want a situation where if you walk into a labor center, you register. We want to have a system where we can, and this will be preceded by this bill. We want to ensure that all employers register their vacancies on this portal, on the one side. On the other side, we want to make sure that all the job seekers register with their profiles, and then we do the matchmaking. And we want to get to a situation where if you were, for instance, unemployed for whatever reason and you're drawing on the UIF, if we have found a job for you, as an example, and you decide out of your own volition that you don't want this job, then you want to be able to turn off the temp because you are deliberately not wanting to be in the job. So once we have that kind of a system going, and part of the vision is to also work very closely with the local municipalities so that we are able to tell each mayor what is their situation on the ground. Each mayor must know how many people are unemployed in their area and so on. So all that kind of cross-pollination with local government is what we plan to do once we have the system up and going. So all plans are afoot to make sure that we get this multi-purpose portal going. And we also think that, Chair, this will also help business, especially the second-tier companies that cannot always afford the placement fees and recruitment fees and so on. When this portal is up and running, it should be welcomed by business because it will ensure that you just register your vacancies and call the department and we say to you, voila, here are the people that match your spec kind of thing. So I think that multi-purpose will be very crucial, Chair, in terms of dealing with the crisis that we have. Sheltered employment for people with disabilities. Chair, as you would know, that as a department we have this outfit where people with disabilities are working. I think at some point members of this committee would really extend an invitation to visit these centers where you see people with disabilities, the beautiful work that they do, excellent piece of work. In fact, I think it's tragic that a lot of departments are not utilizing this facility for furniture. I can say this year, Chair, that in fact the furniture in my office has all been made by these people. They make excellent furniture. And I think because it's a government outfit, one of the things that we would be encouraging all of us to be doing is to be ordering furniture from these people. Chair, they deliver quickly. They make the absolute stunning furniture. I can assure you they've got all the material. Whether you want mahogany, imbuya, or anything, they have it all. Whether you're doing steelworks, they've got steelworks capability. They've got wooden capability. It's just amazing, Chair. what these people are capable of doing. So I would really be saying if this committee can help us to ensure that we give these people business, it will really help us. So we're planning to increase a lot of employment of people with disabilities using this avenue here. Then, Chair, I move on to the UIF. Again, there at a high level, we're looking at improving benefits in the UIF. There's always pros and cons when you do that. We're looking at increasing the number of months that you would be able to withdraw from the UIF. Again, not because we're legislating laziness, but we're reacting to a reality on the ground that there is a shortage of jobs. So we're reacting to that particular situation, that now that we have some kind of more people than their jobs, so we're trying to make sure that people have got some kind of income for a while. I've spoken to the IDC investment where we gave them $2 billion to make sure that the brief for that $2 billion is to say to them that the project that they must approve must be projects that are job creation kind of projects. So that's the brief that they have. So we think that as a department, we are very sensitive and are very clear that the money that we have control over is focused and directed to achieving the goal. Compensation fund. Here, Chair, as some of the members might have been at the SCOPA, our focus here is very simple, that we want to implement the recommendations of the Auditor General. That's what we're working on. So that we want to improve the audit opinion in this fund, and want to implement a turnaround strategy. Okay, so that those are the things that we don't have a lot of frills to be doing here, where there's a lot of fixing that we need to do internally within this fund to make sure that it works. So we're working flat out, Chair, I can assure you. By working flat out in this division to make sure that the internal mechanics are working, the interface with the customers, the clients is working, and all of that. So working very hard here to achieve this. If I look at the inspection and enforcement service, we are now, Chair, have got a program for the whole year. Every month there will be a blitz, and this blitz will be targeted largely at the targeted sectors to improve compliance. Here, we are really worried about the vulnerable people more than anybody else. Here, the serious focus is on vulnerable people. We visit farms. We've been to the Dorrance in the past couple of weeks in a blitz led by the minister. But we're targeting all those kinds of vulnerable places like farm workers. We're looking at the hospitality industry. We're looking at security industry and mining as well as a sector. So those key sectors where there's a lot of abuse of the vulnerable people are focusing on that to make sure that there's compliance. Chair, we found, in fact, that sometimes even the sectoral determinations, people have found a way of abusing them. Where, for instance, you would, in the year 2000, come up with a sectoral determination that somebody must earn 1,000 rand, as an example, per month. Now, you find that 10 years later, that the employers will still show you that sectoral determination to say, this is what your government said, we must pay you. And then they don't increase the salary with inflation and all of that. But part of the legislation changes amendments is dealing with those kinds of things. But we've discovered a whole lot of things. For instance, Chair, just to give you a flavor, is that we find that in the seasonal workers, that a worker would stop working in June. And this, in fact, is a problem why we find a lot of overcrowding and a lot of frustration in our labor centers. Some of them are induced by what employers do. So what happens is you find a situation where the season finishes in June, and the person is unemployed from June. Now, when this, but then what then happens, as they get discharged, but the employer keeps them in the books as if they are still employees. Now, when this worker goes to the UIF offices in the labor center to claim for an unemployment, and when we check with the employer, we find but they are still employed, so we can't pay the benefit. But the person has been discharged. But the employers there, they say, but this person is coming in June. It's an administrative nightmare to take them on and take them off. But the consequences of all of that is that the workers get shortchanged in the process. So we are issuing all kinds of orders for employers to comply. That if people are discharged, they must be off your books, because then if they're off the books, they're able to access the benefit. So we're looking at those kinds of things. Professionalization of inspectors. What we're doing there, Chair, is to ensure that we've got square pegs and square holes with this kind of professionalization. So that if you have a building to be inspected, people that must go there must be people with some kind of a civil engineering kind of background. If we have electrical, what have you, people with that kind of training must be the ones that inspect that kind of an operation, so and so on and so on. So we're trying to make sure that our inspectorate leads to that. Now the challenge, obviously, for the next coming year is that going forward in making sure that this happens, it means that the salary structure of this inspectorate must change. Chair, because traditionally inspectors are not your highest paid people generally. Now that is a challenge. You can't say that you want professionals, but you keep paying blue collar salaries. That's a challenge that we have here. So what then happens is that a lot of our inspectors, they get the experience, and before you know, they get poached, and they become safety officers. They become all kinds of things in the private sector. So we really need to relook at the salary structure of this department in terms of inspectors. So it's something that we're aware of, and we're working on making sure that the people here, they get the salaries commensurate with their professional backgrounds. Right now, we are not doing that. And then, Chair, on this LP and labor market policy division, What we're doing here, this is a division that we have now. What we've now done in the department is to centralize all the law making capability. We don't want a situation where different departments are dealing with a piecemeal approach to whatever law they have. So this department is now going to be central in making sure that all the legislation that we need to create this enforcement is happening. Just at the high level, Chair, in terms of the Labor Relations Act, the amendments that we are doing there will ensure that we deal with this labor broking story, we deal with the subcontracting, we deal with outsourcing. There's a draft deal that, Chair, I'm happy to say that this morning I've just signed the submission to the Minister. So by end of business today, the Minister will have all the proposals relating to the three acts as you have them here. What is it that the department are proposing? We also have been waiting, actually, also in terms of labor broking, for a report from Parliament in terms of the good work that this committee has been doing. But we are ready to incorporate as well all of that. But we've done our part with the information that we had. And we think that it will do a good job in terms of dealing with the things as outlined here. Basic conditions of employment, the sectoral determinations and enforcement, that is the nub of the issue there, Chair, in terms of what is it that we're dealing with on the basic conditions of employment. That sectoral determination, as I've indicated earlier, to make sure that there's escalations in salary, that people understand that minimum wage does not mean maximum wage. So minimum wage is minimum wage, it does not mean maximum wage. Right now, the sectoral determination has been interpreted to mean maximum wage by the employer. So we're trying to make sure that that is clear. On Employment Equity Act, what we're doing there is really to strengthen the enforcement capability of this law. We want to reduce the reaction time. For instance, when we find that you have not complied, we don't want a situation where we say we give you 6 months to comply, especially on procedural compliance. Something like if you have not submitted a report, we don't want to say you have 6 months to submit a report. That doesn't make sense. If you have not submitted a report, you have broken the law. This piece of legislation must ensure that it's got the capability to deal with the employer that has not submitted a report. Right now, it cannot. The law is very inhibiting in terms of how you act on people that are breaking the law. So there's a whole raft of policy changes that we are recommending there, simply to make sure that this law is taken seriously and this law can react quickly. It's a very frustrating thing. We get a lot of inquiries from people about a whole lot of things that are going wrong, but the law is not able to respond timeously to deal with those issues. So that's what we're doing here, to make sure that that happens. Now, Chair, because you know that, if I look at the number of companies that in the past cycle reported, it was over 10,000 companies that reported. So in order to make sure that we're effective as a department, we focus on, we do an 80-20 principle. So we focus on the JSE listed companies and the multinationals. These are the companies that have got all the resources to do the right things and so on. And we think that if you focus on them, because their reports are also public as well, and so on, most of what they do is public. We'll focus on them. And we're hoping that this year we want to do less barking and more biting this year, Chair. So we've been very quiet deliberately, because we now want to set some examples with one of or two of companies that are breaking the law. That's really the intention here. So we're going to focus on these big companies and the multinationals, as it were. There's a lot of issues that we've got information about, a lot of abuses that are happening in these esteemed companies. So we'll be focusing on them. And then, towards conclusion, Chair, all of this is not possible without a strong institutional capacity of the department. So we are focusing very much on filling up our vacancies, and we're increasing the, in summary, also increasing the capacity and visibility of the inspectors, just at a high level there, Chair. What we also are doing is to introduce a uniform for the inspectors. Our inspectors will have uniform. We're also going to deal with the issue of, that was raised in this committee last time, the issue of the inspectors not having cars. We're actually going to buy them cars. There's going to be departmental cars. They're going to be green cars. They're going to have a yellow thing at the top, a yellow light at the top. They're really going to look like inspectors. So that's what we want to do, to ensure that the inspectors have got visibility and are enabled to go and do their jobs. So that's what we're going to do there. In the next 2 days, Chair, next 3 days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we're going to be involved in a final workshop with the ILO, because what we want to do is, as we rejig our structure, we want to make sure that our structure is in line internationally with what other labor departments are doing globally. So we've got that benchmarking exercise going. So the next 3 days towards Friday, we'll be off-site with the team to make sure that our structure looks right. We want to make sure that what we deliver here is world-class. So that's what we're doing. Our ICT strategy in the department, we're also putting a lot of energy, Chair, to make sure that this works. And one of the things that we've done now, to make sure that the ICT system is up to speed, we ensure that every month the DDGs that are responsible for their programs, they sign off on all the work that has been done. And if that has not been signed off, we don't pay. So that has injected a lot of energy and a lot of determination within the ICT company that we're dealing with. And we've revised targets. We are really back almost up to speed, Chair, to ensure that that whole malaise that was happening is corrected. So there's a lot of urgency all around to deliver on this. What we've also done within our labor centers is to introduce a DG service line. So what we want to do is the purpose of this is so that we don't want to hear from the president that there's something wrong in the Department of Labor. We want to hear it for ourselves and deal with it. So we've created a capacity for people to tell us directly that there is this kind of a problem. So what we've done, we've also built, in the head office, we've also built capacity to ensure that there's people that can handle this, can deal with these problems, can revert to people. Because sometimes the question of communication, the person just wants to know, when is this going to happen? Sometimes even that answer is not coming out. So we're building capacity to be able to respond so that people know where we are with things, what we're doing, etc. So we're building that capacity so that people that come to the Labor Center to report things, they must be enabled to be able to do that. And then lastly, Chair, we are intensifying the performance management system, and we're introducing a system where we monitor each other on a monthly basis. That will give us a quick early warning system in terms of how is performance going, so that we can take the appropriate action based on what comes out of that performance thing. Chair, I think at a high level, that's what the department plans to do going forward, and as I said, we are waiting for the minister to issue the budget speech, and then we can drill down even more. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, PG.
For the details, I think it is detailed. More than what we expected before the budget vote of the minister. I'm sure the members will be able to engage and advise where they think that there are things that need to be added in what you have just told us. I will give over to the members to ask questions and clarities. Honourable Matisha.
No, thanks, Chair. Before one can think ahead, I'll just ask you a question for clarity. On page 3, the DG talks about our presence throughout the country. But then indicates there that they are present in two areas, Gauteng province, south and north, etc. But you see, one is quite worried about the exploitation that is there. And I'm further worried about what was said before, because it's a repetition kind of this whole thing. So, two things. Number one, the issue of inspectors that you intend introducing, to say, how do you evaluate that? Evaluation of the inspectors, because I didn't hear it being mentioned. Secondly, the president spoke about inspection in formal industries, for example, in schools, etc., etc. If you could explain how that is going to be really done. That's the first area that one would like to raise. Because once that is done, I then will be able to interact really with the whole thing. I think basically the DG, the Department of that's what handled well, in my own understanding, in respect of planning. But if one chair could just be, you know, clarified there, we'll be able to interact. Thank you.
Did I hear you correctly when you were asking the clarity between the inspectors that the president referred to in terms of inspecting the schools and the inspectors that were referred to by the DG?
Well, that is the same thing.
Are you asking clarity on that?
Yes, because I heard the DG talking about the vulnerable areas, etc., etc., okay, in the farms, I suppose in the mines, etc., etc., where people are exploited, they die, and so on. But then, as an example, the president spoke about, I'm giving you an example, Chair, I suppose you remember, in the schools, for example, and other formal areas, I did not hear that being raised. So hence I'm saying, if it could be clarified there, how that is going to be done, so that we then can be able to interact. So the issue of schools, I was just giving an example, because it will not only be in that area, but then in the health sectors, for example, and a whole lot of other areas where our people will want to see a delivery.
Thank you, Honorable Madisha. Honorable Shelley? Okay, Kumalo, please.
Thanks, Chairperson. My first question will be on your public employment service, on the item of multi-purpose portal. I just want to find out as to how will this happen, what measures will be put in place. Like, are you going to be headhunting workers, jobless, job seekers, as well as employment in order for them to declare their vacancies? How what measures are you going to put in place to ensure that this is happening? Secondly, I haven't heard you touching the issue of tech industry in terms of on your IES, because we are more than interested in knowing what is the department doing in ensuring that inspectors are going there, because I mean tech in industry is the most vulnerable industry. But I haven't heard you whether maybe it is missed, but I would like to hear more. Lastly, Chairperson, I just want to get a clarity on the issue, on the proposed amendment bill. I see the labor blocking in brackets. I just want to check if does it help us that there will be amendment on the that will be put on Labor Relations Act in terms of labor blocking. What will happen then? Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Shelley. Go on, please.
Thanks, Chairperson. Mine is just one question about the on this slide on the presence throughout the country. I'm just interested in the 2,000 centers. Here you say out of the 139 2,000 centers that are throughout the country, you are only existing or you only operate out of 72. What informs that? And maybe can when you come back, this is just a brief, just have some dots around the provinces so that we are able to see where is this 72 centers, where are these offices in the 2,000 centers, so that you can see throughout the provinces through the spread whether all the areas are represented. And I'm just interested to also find out when are you going to be throughout the 2,000 centers, because I think that's where our work is actually done, because the 2,000 centers are located within our constituencies, and we need to be working with the department on those areas in our villages. think that was just a clarity and information seeking.
Ma'am, Honorable Ransola.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I've got too many questions. I wish you can allow me to do that. I'm not quite clear what you are referring to when you're saying people on UIF are going to be placed, and if they can refuse to take the offer, probably the tap will be closed. We want to know, what mechanism are you going to use? Please don't take us back to apartheid era, where you are told go and work there, whether you've got skill or you can afford your health, everything is not taken into consideration. So we just want to know, what criteria are you going to use to select those people or use it? Because they are not working. You're going to do like labor brokers who just back and say, I'll pay you 100 grand, get here, just because people are not working. I should think that shouldn't lead to exploitation. But we'll hear from how you're going to do that, because it's a quite worrying factor. That you are also worried about the employers. You are not talking anything about your sensitivity to the workers. Who you gonna do that to them? I'm not quite sure what they can do. And then on the disability one, you are not talking about. I hear you talking about the center, what you believe, and all. You're not telling us that what is your projection? Because here we are talking about the state of the nation and how we see ourselves getting there. Not that what you are doing now. The state of the nation do deal with certain issues and how we see ourselves here addressing those issues. So that as the people who are going to vote for that budget, we understand what you're going to do. Not that you give us a blanket and we all cover it and say it's fine. It's not going to work. Mm. But I should think it is important to tell us at the workplace, that that's the responsibility of the Department of Labor. How are you going to see the access of disabled people? How are you forcing employers to ensure that they employ disabled people? For us to buy financials from disabled institutions, it's not enough. It's not enough if the people in disabled family cannot, community cannot be employed because they are disabled. How are we going to ensure that they are getting employed and there's access at the workplace, even at the public transport, they don't have any access. Even at the company's entrances, those people doesn't have access. How are we going to follow up that? Ensure that there's an inspection to ensure that there's access to those people at the entrances, at the workplaces that they're taken care of. You go to the canteen, you don't find any table meant for a wheelchair. We'll find a person standing there far from other people. How are we going to ensure that the disabled community is also looked after and is employable, and how we train them? To train them to make finances only, I don't think that is enough. We need to say, in the other sectors, how are we going to see the disabled people being able to function or to work? How are we going to do that as Department of Labor to ensure that? And I should think there must be clear that companies need to employ them. The compensation fund, I'm not happy with what's going to happen, because I'm not quite sure what's going to happen. What's going to happen? What are you going to do on this compensation fund? You have seen, apart from the recommendations, you talk about that only we implement what the auditors are saying, that is part of the measures we support. But what is the strategic plan of the, I should think even in the last meeting, that's what we're saying. Apart from what auditors have said, which I should think auditors are aligning themselves more on what the gap will want to justify and how, where you are doing wrong, that's fine. But what is it that you're going to do to ensure that what you are raising, it was disappointing to hear that we don't have staff. We don't have staff which is adequately trained. We want to hear that. more than you're going to implement. Implementation is one of the things you should do as per that letter of management letter of the auditors. But you have raised that people, you don't have qualification, you don't have, what are you going to do to assist those people? To assist that those departments, they don't default anymore. I'm not sure of this recall list. That recall list, what order, how are you going to recall people? Are you going to make a list of the people and you recall them? Or are you going to just call everybody to work? I don't understand. I'm not clear on what you are saying there. I'm not sure what you are talking about. The sectoral determination, the sectoral determinations are so open for abuse. In the last meeting, we talked about the interpretation of clause by clause. How clause one supersedes the second clause, or how they complement each other. They are standalone clauses. I'll tell you about 19A of one. 19A of the retail. It says the company will provide uniform, and then you say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. When you go to clause B, it doesn't say that. It means only those. It's talk about overall. I think Les Cattles will understand exactly what I'm saying. I always say the 1962 sectoral determination of retail was the best, because it was saying for anything you do, you must supply the uniform. But now you are categorizing. It's categorized now. And if you don't fall in that category, then the companies are failing to do that. And at CCMA, Department of Labor is failing to interpret that. What does that mean? Because if it's fashion and style, uniform, what should happen? Should I buy it at a cost price, as per what clause 16, I should think, saying, sub 16A, B or C saying? So it's such a contradiction. I should think you are not saying anything about the interpretation which we raised last time, that you are working very hard to interpret the sectoral determination. Also the interpretation as so far as what is a worker. What is the worker according to the current sectoral determinations? None of them are defining a worker. I should think that's why we are talking about the labor market thing. But you can't go to labor market unless we define what is a worker, what is an employee. I mean, what is a worker, what is an employer? Because that's what I should think the gist of the sectoral determination to that sector need to talk to, which is not doing it at the current conjunction. And, I mean, there are a lot of things. You talk about the professional salary of the inspectors. But you are not telling us what you're going to do with your current one, prior learning recognition. I've seen in the other sectors, when people who are educated come in, they just check out those who are not educated because they believe they're educated. But those departments have been working fruitfully before those educated people come in. I will make a lot of example about it. So you are not telling about that. What are you going to do with the current inspectors which are there? How are you going to develop them to reach that level you want? Not telling us that one day you will be. We are talking here about job retention, sustainable of livelihood. How you see that with your current staff? I should think that's what we are saying. We need to address exactly the state of the nation so that you are able to support the vote, the budget vote. Otherwise, we cannot. Chairperson, I want to go lastly. I'll come back if you come again. On the legislation, I understand that you've got a bill which you've got to the, you gave to the minister. I don't think as a committee I've ever seen those bills. And then we cannot rubber stamp, but that will wait for the minister to come. As a committee here, we're expected to vote for the bills and do that. But if we didn't see them, we just report to us today, it becomes a bit of a problem that how we support that next time as a committee. It is important that you also give to us, because the bills will have to come to the portfolio committee to adopt or to ratify or to debate that with them. But if it's a done deal and you come and tell us that, it's a problem, and it will make us very negative towards it in the future. I should think, as the minister is part of this committee, you wait for him till he brought it to us, and then you can report about it. But when you report about it, already when you come with it, we say, hey, hey, wait a minute, we know that this has long been given to you, so that that conflict situation doesn't come. But I'm just saying, we hope that the minister will deal with it. But honestly, the president has also spoken about 480,000 workers who are in the employment. What are we talking about? And the president talked about the decent job. I've seen you say in one line, you talk about decent life, but I was waiting for you to motivate. What is this decent life, decent work, according to the state of the nation? So that when we motivate it, we move from that understanding. So if it is not yet done, we believe as a committee, that's what we're going to expect from you. Lastly, I won't bother you anymore, Chair, is that you talk about professionalism and the companies you are going to focus. I'm sorry, I forgot that when I was talking about the inspectors. You are going to concentrate on the multinational companies, which just, they've got a code, international code, which is supposed to be followed. You must tell us whether the department is unable to implement the code on the multinationals. Because there is a law, there is everything, and where are they failing? So that we can be able to say, okay, we agree on what you're going to say, do. JSE, what about small businesses, which are the worst exploiters? They're the worst off. All the small businesses are being exonerated, the threshold of them is not being checked, their profit margin is not being checked, so that you can say, because they are doing well. You are not saying they are doing well. I mean, for years I heard, maybe you are new, but I've been hearing that you will concentrate on JSE companies listed and the multinationals. But the small companies, which are, and companies now are franchising in such a way that they've got small business, so that they are out of those big monsters. I know that one of the biggest retail in the continent wanted to delist. We're held by certain companies to restore them. So if they do that, and you concentrate on the big ones, and they delist, and they form Molanyana, Eric, Alina, Joyce, Yengeni companies, and they are not looked after. I think if you are concentrating on the big companies, that create that franchising and separation and delisting of companies. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Lowe.
Was
it? Oh, yes. Start it all, please. You can start it all. I'm coming this way. Please.
Thank you, Chair President. There's a couple of things that were mentioned in the President's speech that I thought you might comment on. He said, on page 7 of his speech, we must also increase the number of youth who enter learnerships in the private and public sectors. How are we going to increase the number? Have you got a plan to market to them, to get them involved, or what? How are we going to increase the number of them? I assume the FET colleges will be taken up by education, so we perhaps won't get a comment on that. But there are two other things that he mentioned in his speech which are not falling in the Labour Department, but perhaps just some comments, because they're concerning Labour and how many people are employed and so on, and creating jobs, and we are the Labour Department. So we don't implement these things, but perhaps we can just get information. And there's this Industrial Policy Action Plan, green jobs and stronger and more labour-absorbing industries. And then there's the public works, 480,000. I don't expect that we will monitor those, but at least as the Department of Labour, you sit on those joint boards. And maybe we could just get a little more information, because we don't have any information. It's news to us when the President makes a pronouncement. And then in terms of your presentation, on page 9, you spoke about the three parts which are going to be taken up in the new bill. And I want to ask you, the training layoff scheme, can we get an update on how many people have now been trained? I don't want to have to go to all the trouble of writing a whole list of parliamentary questions. If you can just tell us approximately, it will save us trouble of writing formal questions. The multi-purpose portal, it sounds almost like an employment agency. And I want to know, is the Department of Labor now competing with the employment agencies that are out there? And if so, why do we need to do that? Are we going to do better than them, faster than them? Are we in a different niche? Maybe the employment agencies cater for a certain income bracket or something, and we filling in another income bracket where they don't bother, so we're going to try and help the industry. Or why are we competing with employment agencies? I find that an interesting concept. It's useful to tell the mayors how many unemployed people are in their towns, but I'm not sure what they're going to do with that. And then I share Comrade Alina's concern about the compensation fund. One of my concerns is, you know, that we get from our constituencies a lot of these complaints, and we refer them. You know, here's my list. You can see all the complaints that we've referred. And it's, when we started referring them to the commissioner, he was dealing with them personally, and he did a good job. And then we handed over to a staff member who came to see us, and that person did quite a good job. But it's now started to slow down again, so that we are now in a procedure where we send through the complaints and we just don't hear back. They refer it to somebody else in the department. So the liaison person is still referring it, but then we don't get the feedback. It's just sort of, so I'm concerned about this. If we are not even getting feedback, you know, I'm concerned the public's not getting feedback on their own complaints, and you know, how are we going to speed that up? I don't know. With regards to the inspectorate, you spoke about the vehicles, which is a good step in the right direction. I think that's wonderful. Are you increasing the number of inspectors? Because also the total number for the whole country is few compared with, I mean, it's a huge country and long distances. Are you increasing the number of inspectors as well as providing the vehicles? I think the vehicles are the right thing to do. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Honorable Law.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I would just like maybe to make a comment. My colleague already made a comment about this list, Chairperson, through you. The reason why this list was compiled was duly because of the frustrations that people have experienced. That is why we've got this list. But it doesn't seem as if this list is helping us much. Because as was mentioned, and I just like to reiterate, that it's almost like, you know, a new broom that sweeps clean. The lady that was assisting us, through you, Chair, was doing a stunning job, but for a very short period of time. And thereafter, we just happened to fall back into the old habits. So, and this list is but just some. There are many other of these lists, but we can talk about it later. Question one. The Department of Labor have a turnaround strategy. How and by when will this strategy assist the Department of Labor in terms of the recruitment of competent people, i.e., last week we said the Department of Labor was presented in front of SCOPA, and there we heard the commissioner sitting there right in front of me saying that they don't have competent people in doing the work, or they don't have skilled enough people in order to do the work. Now my question goes further, i.e., compensation acknowledged of the challenges when they had to appear in front of SCOPA in terms of the documentation and all of those things. Now, I want to know, how is the turnaround strategy going to assist the department in addressing that? The second one, during our recent period, I visited, within my constituency, I visited a Department of Labor Center. And there were two challenges that they are sitting with. The first one is, and I said this before in one of our meetings, every week when I read the paper, especially the city press to be specific, you advertise every week religiously in the city press. And I'm getting very excited seeing that there are some advertisements placed. But some of these adverts are repeating them over and over. I know what is the reason for that, because I've made it my duty to go and find out what is the reason for that. The reason for that is NIE. When you people have to do the screening of these incumbents whom you anticipate to employ, it's taking way too long with the process of assisting the department with the screening process. I would like to find out how is the turnaround strategy going to assist you with that. SAQA, equally so. When you people submit the incumbent's credentials and whatever to SAQA in order to test the authenticity about the qualifications, that also takes very long. Now, I want to know how is your turnaround strategy going to assist you in order to address that. The Department of Labor mentions the, and another thing, SAQA can only assist up to a certain level in terms of the data that they've got available on their computers. Apparently, the moment when you ask for information in the 80s, it's not captured on the computer system because they don't have that information. They also need to rely on another service provider in order to assist. How are you people going to assist in terms of your strategy to make sure that you are going to assist with that as well? The DG mentioned that the Department of Labor is looking at a DG line. Just want to make sure that I capture that. Service line. It's well and fine to hear that we are going to introduce a service line. We've heard of service lines previously, and another service line is being introduced. Well, that then mean I won't have to come and sit with these lists anymore. Because originally this list was presupposed to have been sorted out. There was no need for us sitting with this list for year in and year out. My question is, will the service line assist in order to address some of these things as well? The trading layoffs, I'm not going to ask a question on that one. It was already exhausted. The DG also mentioned about closing of the tap in terms of, was that now the multi-purpose portal? Am I right? A thought crosses my mind. Are we then not going to infringe on the rights of the particular individual in the event if the person is not in a position, not necessarily is not interested in getting a job or want to be employed? Because I would think every normal person would then prefer to be employed than receiving the stipend or receiving the benefit from the Department of Labor. Are we then not going to infringe on the rights of the individual if we do that by closing the tap? Because not very long ago, UIF was a given that if you became unemployed, you could actually rely on the fact that you will get your UIF. And that is no more the case. Are we not heading there again and indirectly infringing the benefits, or rather the rights, of South Africans by doing that? I hope this was the first round, Chair. Mm-hmm. There's another round of questions.
Yes.
Honorable Duma.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just two things. The first is, I don't know, maybe because I'm not a member of the committee, the issues were dealt with in other meetings. But I'm interested to know and understand whether the department has analyzed and gave, you know, a criteria to a decent job. Because it seems to me that there is a big debate of what constitutes a decent job. And when the department says it's going to ensure, you know, that priority is met, what yardsticks is the department going to use to say indeed there were decent jobs created and there is no contest in the country about what constitutes a decent job? Whether the department has engaged, you know, in that debate and it is trying to influence other departments at the country as a whole, what constitutes a decent job. The second issue is on retrenchment, where the department comes in and say to companies, we're giving you 50%, don't retrench. whether, you know, there is a line that can be followed, that we agree that all has been tried by both parties in the dispute about wages or about whatever reasons that were given to retrench, that we as a department, we are satisfied and we are convinced that the parties to the dispute have reached a deadlock, they can't settle any longer, and therefore we now come in. At what stage are you coming in to offer the 50%? Because, you know, I believe that this issue is between the two parties. And at what stage is the department convinced that the parties have, in fact, you know, exhausted all processes that were in place to deal with the dispute? The last issue is just a comment, Chair, that if the department has a program on bills and how those bills must be finalized, it must discuss that with the committee, and it is the committee that is much competent and put in a better place to know how the program is, and not the department. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Honorable Nyakeba.
Thank you very much. The first point that I want to raise is that there are positive feedbacks that we're getting from constituencies where we're deployed. Remember, constituency is not necessarily, it might not necessarily be people who are unemployed, who complained about non-payment of UIF or were not paid by a compensation fund. But at the same time, a relationship between employees at the provincial offices, I'm saying we do get positive responses, saying that when workers, some through their trade unions, when they call upon senior management or spoke to the director general that we've got this problem, then there's a quick response to that. That's a feedback that I received from the provincial office in Johannesburg. I think keep up that good work. That's what. But the second point is in this presentation of the briefing. Remember, the State of the Nation address was last week, Thursday. It was sitting here Tuesday. And I think it's important to say to the department, I think you have worked very quick in trying to look at what is it that you want to line it with the State of the Nation address in making things better for the department in moving forward. Even if you still know that there's still going to be a budget board discussion that has to take place. You did that even before the minister has presented that. The third point is about I think there has to be a way, I don't know how, but I think maybe the department can look and think about that. We have had all the problems, in particular in the compensation fund, within the department. Yes, we have also told of a plan how to deal with those problems last year. I was still getting lost, Mr. Nondwa, here, when I went to exit, because I was new when these things were mentioned. And I think at that stage, what we have said is that the commissioner, what he needs to do, he mustn't wait for the 3 years of the turnaround strategy. What he has to do, he has to continuously brief and submit kinds of reports to the portfolio committee in order for the portfolio committee to know how problems are being dealt with. And I think we are privileged to be called, to be invited by SCOPA last week to hear on the part of employment, because you had a number of people who were not permanent in your area of work. But at least it's important now, we had that, but it's not necessarily a report that comes to us. You were responding to a question. I think you need to find a way of how do you deal, how do you make us to be in the same line with you in knowing of what is happening. One critical issue, Chair, is in the presentation, I'm not hearing the interaction between the department and trade unions. I think it's important. How the department intends to interact with trade unions in order to make sure that even this turnaround strategy that we have put in place, it doesn't become a failure or being challenged in the process, simply because you haven't taken trade unions on board in driving the strategy itself. So I think that's one area if the department is not doing, but you need to look at that. There's this multi-purpose portal. This is good. The purpose of it is very good. I once heard, because I didn't have a privilege to travel to other countries, but sometimes we normally depend in interacting with people who are coming from those countries. Before I came to Parliament, I used to interact with people who have traveled to China in particular, where it is the responsibility of the Department of Labor. As benefits are dispatched by the Department of Labor, and then the Department of Labor has all the details of that individual who applied for the unemployment insurance fund, where this person was working, all the details, what kind of skills does this person have. And then if then there are vacancies, companies feed to the Department of Labor, to that section within the Department of Labor, in order for the Department of Labor, when it received such information, you know that you have this list of people who have the skills that are required in the vacancies from these different companies. So the point for me is, are you then in a way trying to look at that? Because if that might be the approach that the department wants to take, it's not a sin for the department to do that, because you are having a register of unemployed people, because you have a benefit of unemployment insurance. This is called unemployment insurance fund. So then companies feed you with that information, the issue will be, how do you deal with the capacity in order to make sure that is effective? The I think the other point, which I think, if you can now, this issue of inspectorate, DG is not for the first time for this issue to be raised to us, in particular to look at how do you attract people of who are having the qualification to do the work, like the salaries and benefits. I think in moving forward, you also, at a particular time, brief us as to what is it that you have put in place now to make sure. I know we are not employing the portfolio committee. That is not our competence. We are politicians. But I think it's important for us to be informed time and again as to how far are you, because it's one of the key areas that the department has to look at. The last point, Chair, you see, I'm looking at this line, page 4. Our purpose to regulate the labor market. I think that's key. That's my understanding, but I'm subject to be corrected. The Department of Labor does not employ its contractors, but what is the responsibility of the Department of Labor is to make sure that core matters follow all the labor legislation. That's why you're inspectorate. I'm not entering into it, but I'm just raising that lay off training, which is the last point. You see, the briefing that we had last year was that the Department of Labor is offering its services in an event where there is a particular company that wants assistance, where the training layoff issue will come in. It's not necessarily the Department of Labor putting its ears on the ground and says, come at us as a strategic advisor and say, we are here, we are here. It's come at us that must come. But I think maybe the issue that might be lacking less in that setup is, do trade unions have a right to approach the CMA? I'm not certain whether it does give trade unions that right, whether they have to agree jointly with the employer that the stage we find ourselves now, let us approach the CMA. So I'm saying, in order for it, and also for us to see it addressing the purpose it was made for, I think we need to find out whether there are no loopholes where trade unions do not have a chance of approaching the Department of Labor. Thank you very much.
Honorable Albert.
You see, madam, so when I came in, I was thinking that I'm sitting in between officials.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just three questions. With regard to the Public Employment Service Bill that's envisaged, training layoff is a good idea, but I also want to know whether the department considers it within the jurisdiction to also look at entrepreneurial training. So for those ones who do not wish to stick with normal jobs, actually want to start their own businesses, that should be regarded as a good thing, because we need new businesses to create more jobs in the country. And if there are people who are capable of doing that, then that would be a good thing if the department can also play a role in that regard. I like the sheltered employment for people with disabilities idea. I would just like to know more about it. What does it entail? What is the process for, well, the department assist employing, finding employment for those people, and what would be the definition of a sheltered employment for those categories of people? And then lastly, with regards to the amendments envisaged for existing legislation, Employment Equity Act, this might be the opportunity to consider to clarify certain uncertainties in the Act, like the meaning of the word representativity, and also having regard to a greater vision where you can get to a point where you find that there's equilibrium in the marketplace and that you can reconsider allowing minorities to come back into the marketplace, specifically those born after 1994. Thank you very much.
Thank you, members. DG, so over to you and the department.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Yeah, one of the purposes of bringing such a large delegation is that they help me. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to start from the end, there through you, Chair, and ask them to pick up everything relating to PES, see under everything relating to inspectorate, Nonduangu, pick up everything, shelter employment, shakes, pick up your CF matters. Whatever is left out, Chair, I will pick up from my end. So if you allow me, we can work our way that way. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. There were a number of questions around the bill. Yes, we are still in the very, very early drafting stages, and once we have a draft that is fit to see the sun, obviously you will be the first people that we are going to discuss the draft to you. Whilst we are following the other normal parallel processes of cabinet and all that. And we are also in the process of looking at the question of the stakeholder participation, because we know that there are UPSOs, the trade unions and so on are very, very much interested in this area. So I take Honorable Nyakemba's comments very seriously, and we have already looked at them. But just on the macro level, why are we getting involved and the context? I think there's a big debate around how do we as a country increase the levels of employment among South Africans. Now, this has got a number of elements to it. On one hand, just before recession, everybody was saying we've got a lot of jobs, we've got a lot of projects, the Eskom, rail and all that, stadiums. We want to build and move fast on that, but the thing that is really impacting on our ability or the country's ability to implement those projects is lack of skills. So on one hand, there's an argument that there are a lot of people who are unemployed with qualifications that are not suitable. On the other hand, there are a lot of jobs that are available but cannot be filled because people don't have the necessary prerequisite skills to fill those jobs. So you're sitting in that kind of a situation where, as government, you then have to intervene. Obviously, there are curriculum-related issues which colleagues in higher education and training and institutions of higher learning are involved in. We're involved in some of those with CITAS around how do we begin to bridge that gap. But linked to that, there's a question of the number of local jobs vis-a-vis, given that debate, how you then deal with the question of balance. Because if you look at most of the stadiums that were built, we have got thousands of foreign workers. Those projects were started with the ultimate aim of also creating jobs for our people. But at the end, some companies, in order to meet the deadline, ended up bringing in foreigners. And again, we had a problem where one company will say, I want work permit to bring in so many people because there are no skills. And without a proper system that can say in this specific municipality, Cape Town, there are so many people with this kind of skills, we can therefore not allow you to bring in so many people from X country. Because of that, people were able to exploit those situations, and that is why some of the projects went ahead, because our systems were not tight. The Immigration Act was also amended to remove all those requirements with regard to the skilled component, checking and all that. And as a result, what we are now having to do between the Department of Labor and the Home Affairs, in terms of the issue of those corporate permits and individual permits, there are lots of problems because the fraud, there are companies taking advantage, there's undermining of labor laws. I mean, if you go to farms and all that, there are people going to all the way Mozambique, Zimbabwe, in the borders, recruiting people, placing them in farms and underpaying them and exploiting this asylum seekers work permits and so on, because there is no proper regulation around it. There are gaps in both the Department of Labor side and the Department of Home Affairs side. So this is what the bill is also going to try and address. Now, just briefly, why would departments such as us get involved in that area, and whether we are competing with other existing agencies that are there? I think there are a number of conventions of the ILO 188 and so on, four of them, that actually clearly outlined, outlines the important role of government in terms of this area, in the licensing of the private placement agencies, because where there is no regulation, there's a free for all. We are still also looking at the question of outsourcing the labor brokers, the recruitment and placement agencies that also have another leg in the labor brokering, and how do you also regulate all those aspects. And the conventions are quite clear around that. And obviously we're drawn on a number of international experience. And Honorable Nyakemba, you are correct. We have looked at the Chinese. We have looked at a number of countries, the Algerians, etc. We have a clear understanding in terms of the linkages between the municipalities and how they work together. Just on the question around how is it going to be done, obviously a strong reliance on IT is going to be key, because things like the portal, if you look at the, you know, things like cell phone, this is a new revolution that you can use beyond computer points, because almost the majority of people, even in rural areas nowadays, have got cell phones, and there are ways that you can reach and send information to those people, whether it's employment vacancies that exist, to make sure that they come in. There will be issues around the staffing levels in the department, cooperation with the private private employment agencies is something that is that we're going to look at seriously, including drawing on international labor experience, international experiences. We are also involved with the ILO in this process. Now, there was a question around, you know, where, how we're going to enforce this, the question of registration of vacancies and so on. Now, there are two kind of measures here. Obviously, there is the incentive one, and there is the punitive one. Now, on the incentive one, I mean, there are a number of innovative ways that other countries have used to get ordinary people to register in the local database, including innovative ways to get companies to register their vacancies. We are planning on a number of campaigns that will assist companies to understand the benefits of using public employment services. If you look at an ordinary advert that is 100 meters by maybe 120 millimeters by 180 or so, in a normal newspaper, those adverts go for something like some go for 300,000 rand. They're quite expensive. And to a small and medium company, it's not worth spending that money if you can have people who are already on the database free of charge, that have been screened, their qualifications verified, that you can easily pick off the system. Obviously, the private agencies, because by in terms of conventions, cannot charge people for that. They make their money from the higher end of the economy, where they place people like CEOs and so on. Because what they then do is that they charge the company, which is the recipient organization, for a placement fee after the successful headhunting for a person. Now, for the medium and the lower level skills, in most cases, those people are just left on their own. And that does not suggest that there is no role for government in higher levels, especially given the national projects that we want to embark upon in those countries that we have long-term agreements. There are also issues that the DG mentioned around the UIF compensation fund and sheltered employment factories link. Yes, it's one thing to talk about the right, but let's take those classical examples. There are people who, I mean, currently you get UI if you are retrenched or if services are terminated, etc. But also, if there's a job and there are skills levels, the advantage of having to look at the local skills and directing people is that at the end, there must be that understanding that the right issues that we must take into account. But at the end of the day, what do we do as a country? Do we issue then work permits to foreigners when there are jobs locally, and we leave South Africans with the skills that could also pay revenue if they take a job that is currently available? Because I'm not saying we should not respect their rights, but I think we'll have to find ways that we can strike balances around there so that we have a smooth kind of a transition that will ensure that we fill jobs that are available with the requisite local skills. Otherwise, the alternative is that we'll have to give companies those work permits and ignore some South Africans. But also, there's a time period. We may have the benefits for 8 months or for a year. Beyond that, you start with that person, and what do you then do? There were some questions that related to the learnerships and so on. I think those are, I mean, in the department, the only role that will be left will be the referral part and the career guidance component, which is also quite important because we have got a lot of young people who come to the Department of Labor offices, the mobile centers, and so on, just to get to understand what is happening in the companies, what kind of jobs are available, and what are the job opportunities. So the career guidance, counseling, and information dissemination is something that we'll continue to do. The training will be done by colleagues in the Department of Higher Education and Training. On the public works job creation initiatives, what has been our role? Honorable Alina, I think in the main, we have worked with a whole range of departments, public works in the main, correctional services, Department of Water Affairs, and so on, Department of Health, and so on, in those projects that we funded, mainly under the National Skills Fund. Most of the Department of Public Works allocations is mainly in the maintenance of buildings. For the training component, they used to come to the Department of Labor for an allocation under the National Skills Fund for the training of new and emerging contractors. In the correctional services, in the rehabilitation programs, the majority, if not 100%, of all the training providers that are operating in prisons used to be funded by the Department of Labor under the National Skills Fund to work with the correctional supervisors in the rehabilitation, retraining of all the offenders in the various skills. So in terms of those numbers, we may not have blown our trumpet in terms of our contribution. but we played a major role in the training component that was given together with CTAS in paying all those learners the salaries that they received and in recruitment and placement of all those learners, because the Public Works Department recruited them from our database. And I think going forward, currently we are in discussions with the Department of Higher Education and Training as part of the remaining aspect of the transfer, because employment services remains with the department, the rest has gone. And how, I mean, the discussions are around how are we going to interface so that we sustain some of the projects that were going on. On the training layoff, up to now, this has been very slow. The DG did outline some of the challenges, but we have in the region of 3,000 people from mainly five companies, and the CCMA is still processing a number of applications. The president did indicate that this is the program that we are going to continue running. Obviously, we'll continue with it. We are in discussions with the NEDLEC social partners to see how best can we market the program, deal with some of the challenges that the DGs outlined, and how we can add some of the, I mean, increase some of the numbers that have been outlined. I think DG, sorry, the last one on the entrepreneurial training component. Now, we used to have this as part of our major program. We believe that this is quite important. The issue, honorable members will recall, that the agency that used to play a major role in this area was Umsobomboyo Fund, because the bulk of our budget was given to them to facilitate the granting of loans young people. And Umsobomboyo Fund has since been transferred to the presidency with all those programs. And these are some of the programs that are continuing under the National the National Youth Development Agency. And we transferred all those programs together with the funding that we had at our disposal. Thank you, DG.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I will talk on the inspectorate. The first question around the inspectorate was how we have evaluated the inspectors. Inspectors have performance agreements, but those were based largely on the targets that were set nationally in terms of how many workplaces do we have to inspect, and therefore they will chase the numbers. And in the performance agreements, they will say you have to conduct so many inspections per week. But then we're changing the focus to be on quality rather than quantity, because we are not confident enough when we're saying, we're pronouncing on levels of compliance to say there is compliance in this particular sector. Hence, I'm saying we're trying to focus on quality now. Hence, we have a program to focus on specific sectors which are vulnerable, where we'll be going in and doing the full audit in terms of compliance to the legislation of the department. And that's the approach that we're going to adopt this coming financial year. In terms of inspections in schools, obviously the inspectors which were referred to in the State of the Nation address are different from those who will be doing the school inspectors who will be doing inspections. But inspections in schools, it's in part, it's part of our program this coming year. It's part of our Blitz program to do inspections in schools and also in hospitals in terms of health and safety issues. Because as we know that, especially in hospitals, they deal with hazardous substances. There's issues of cleanliness. There's issues of general housekeeping matters, where we have to ensure that health and hygiene is also upheld and complied to, in particular to in hospitals. With the taxi industry, I need to admit that we haven't been present there in terms of ensuring that there's compliance. And I think, as we would recall, that this industry has been a volatile industry in terms of the violence and all of that. And we also have a responsibility to ensure the safety of our inspectors as well, because our inspectors get assaulted by employers, especially in farms. So we had to be sensitive to that. But now it is part of our program, of our blitz inspection program, where we'll also focus our attention on this industry. Earlier on, we just were doing awareness campaigns and consultation with the stakeholders involved in the industry. But now, as I say, that it's part of our blitz inspection program for this year. With regards to access to workplaces by disabled people, I think that's part of our inspections in terms of general procedural inspections that our inspectors conduct in terms of access to workplaces. But I think we need to go further than that in terms of ensuring that also in terms of appointments, the promotions that would talk to substantive compliance to our employment equity, and this is what we will be doing. With the two song centers, I think what informed the 72 out of 139 that the DG mentioned, I think what informed us earlier on was the footprint that has been established by the department already in terms of labor centers, satellite offices that we have, and the visiting points that we have. But we've since reviewed our access strategy in terms of ensuring that we also render services in these Tucson centers. Where we have a satellite office, services are rendered in that particular satellite office. But where we have a Tucson center, then we render services in that particular community, in the Tucson Center. And as we go on, we'll then look also at the proximity in terms of where the satellite office is and the visiting point. Like, for instance, in Gauteng, we have a labor center in Soweto, where we're going to have a Maponya Mall as a Tucson Center. Then we're looking at rendering services there. And if it's not going to be cost-effective for us to keep resources in the Soweto Labor Center rather than having those resources at the Maponya Mall, that is the route that we will take. But we've taken note of the comment earlier on in terms of plotting where these Tucson centers are across the country. With regard to professionalization of inspectorate, I think the last time we made a presentation here, we indicated that we categorizing the inspectorate, and we said we're done with the job profile, where we're also reviewing the job profiles of inspectors. We're done with the generalist. But now I can report and say that we are done with the principal inspector category. We are done with the specialist inspector category, which then all those have undergone a job evaluation process. But the challenge, Chairperson, here, I think as the DG has indicated, is the fund in terms of implementing the structure in terms of the levels, because these categories then indicate at what level each category should be pitched. Like, for instance, if we talk general inspector, it should be at a level of, salary level 8, which should be the entry level of an inspector, and they go up to level 12, which is at the manager level. And we challenged here in terms of funding, where we have to implement this to align the salaries with the structures that we're proposing to ensure that we are professionalizing the inspectorate. In our skills audit that we have conducted, we found that 67% of the current workforce that we have is don't have qualification. They don't have a formal qualification. And in this regard, we have engaged the ILO, where they are training those who've got experience, because we have inspectors who've got experience. And we have a program that's been adopted, and which is starting next week with the ILO, where they are capacitating our inspectors to take them to the level that we require them to be. Last time I also reported on the training that was taking place, which was supposed to finish this month. That training is finishing this month. We have a team of inspectors which have been undergoing this training to ensure that we augment the capacity that's lacking within the inspectorate. Thank you, Chip.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Member. I think my question relates to the detailing of what is in the turnaround strategy and what are the things that we're doing and progress to date. Maybe just to indicate that the reason why the DG indicated that we should address the audit qualifications, I think it's very critical. I must indicate that my experience in the public sector is that if an institution does not have audit qualifications, we forget about it. It will never come to SCOPA. And it disappears in the scene, despite the fact that it might have serious delivery problems. So I think we recognize that we need to deal with the audit issues. It's not proper for any organization, either a department, to be unable to manage its funds properly. I think that's a critical thing. So we are addressing that issue as one of the paramount issues, because it gets to the limelight that we need to get out of the audit area so that we can be able to focus more on delivery. So that's one of the issues. The critical challenge around why we have the qualifications, audit qualifications, the critical one is around the way we collect money from employers. The current system of determining a premium is fraught with problems. It's such that it's open to abuse, to the extent that you cannot convince the Auditor General what is it that you're supposed to get from an employer at any point in time. So that is why forever you'll have challenges. Because secondly, is the amount of paperwork that sits in that area that the employers have to submit. There's also a lot of room for revisions. Employers can submit to you what we call preliminary declaration at the beginning of the year to say, I have 100 people, this is the payroll I'm anticipating to pay in that financial year. And then at the end of the year, he must give you a final determination to say, these were the people I've employed, this was the salary, so you must make that revision. And because of the amount of paper load and the filing that is required to keep that paper load, so that when the Auditor General comes and says, but you had a declaration of so much, but this number has changed now, where is that proof? So you need to go back and produce the paper. And we have over 400,000 employers all over the country who are registering, making revisions, closing companies, or restructuring. And that's paperwork that is flowing to and fro. I think that's the area of challenge that we need to address. And the plan in addressing that particular area, one was to look at a scientific approach that could simplify the current determination of premium. We have now finalized the modeling of that. We've done some sensitivity analysis to determine whether the current model that we want to implement is financially viable, because you cannot implement anything that is going to bankrupt the organization. So that model has been tested, the experts, to see that if we implement it, it's going to work. I've just got a report last week, Monday, to say indeed the sensitivity modeling has been done and the thing is ready. What we need now is to try to look at the legislative implication for us to be able to implement the model, and we also need to put in place an action plan to bring on board the employers, because it's going to affect the employers. But the intention is to make it simple and easier for employers to use. It will be based on a short-term insurance principles that if you pollute, you pay. If you don't pollute, you get the benefit. So that's the principle. If you cause more accidents and you injure people, you will pay more. But if you don't, you get the benefit of it. Your premium will get lower and lower. That is an approach simple to manage. And we believe that you don't need inspectors to manage that one. The medical industry will manage it for us. Once somebody is injured, we'll go to hospital. The hospital will claim. So we have a source already of monitoring that we'll use to be able to manage that. So even if the employer does not report the accident, the injured person will come to us, because the hospital or a doctor will claim and will find out if the employer didn't report an accident. And there will be premiums billed for non-compliance. So that's one of the major changes that we are envisaging in that particular area. And it's in the second phase, because we feel we must do small things first. So this one is a major thing. It's coming on the second phase in the last year of the turnaround plan. Having dealt with that, then you say you need systems to be able to implement and manage that. We've gone around, we've picked up the system that will be able to do that, where employers will for the first time fill a paper to register so that we can know them, who they are. Once they are registered, we'll give them the system. They'll be able to make all those declarations and changes on the system, and the system will be able to manage all these changes. So we limit the amount of paper moving around. So that system, as I've indicated earlier on, we got it from Rand Mutual, which is our licensee, and we are now in the process of implementing the system. It's called client care system. So that system will be able to do that. Employers will also be able to register accidents, for example, online using that system, so that they'll be able to get a claim number immediately to be able to send the patient to this hospital immediately from the commission fund. That's the intention in the plan. The other problem that we are trying to address in this plan is the payment of service providers, doctors and hospitals, because currently it takes years and years to pay. Because first you receive an invoice, you must determine whether that invoice is linked to the injury that the worker sustained and whether the treatment that was provided is linked. And this is done manually. People look at this invoice, look at the medical codes, and try to make sense of that. We are saying that's going to be something of the past, because we will implement a system that will be designed around the ICD-10 code, International Standard Coding, that will be able to take an invoice when once it comes in, it will read it and analyze it and link it to the injury, and it will also benchmark the pricing to say, this injury, if it's a head injury, will only pay 3,000 maximum. If the invoice is more than 3,000, then it will flag to say, somebody else senior must look at this thing because it's against the norm. It's what medical aids are doing currently. The system manages these things. People are dealing with exceptions. So we have a Comcare system which is going to handle that. So we'll be able to get a lot of invoices coming electronically via the switching houses. The doctors currently use switching houses to send bills. They don't send them by post as they're doing to the compensation fund. At the moment, we're receiving boxes and boxes of invoices from hospitals for us to process. Those things come via the switching house. Those invoices must be compliant with your rules. If they're not compliant with your rules, they send them back. So the hospital must send the proper information. So that's the future that we're looking at, and we are hoping to implement that during this first phase. That is from April 2010. We will start piloting the system, and we believe that our pilot is premised on being a big bang. that as it is a pilot, we want to roll out nationally so that we can begin to keep the paper away so that our staff can focus on the existing backlog that is there so that we can clear it. And the other issue is that we also looking at the pension administration. I think the biggest problem in the list that you might be having there is around unsettled disputes of whether the disability that I have, we have correctly determined it, whether it's 15%, 20% disability. That is the area of temporary total disablement and permanent disablement, which is called the pension area. We've got a pension care system that is will be able, integrated system. Once we've treated you, the system will be able to look at the diagnosis and all those things to say the disability is 20 or 30 or 40%. And then in the event where you're not happy, we also are suggesting as part of the second phase implementation is the case managers on the ground. We want to network with our doctors on the ground because we believe we can be employing all the time. There is a doctor fraternity across the country where we can send a patient to say, we have said you are 41, we are 41%. Please go to the nearest physician around you there. He must make the determination and we shall accept that determination because it will be an independent verification of the disability by a professionally trained practitioner. Currently, we rely on what a doctor has written on a paper to say, I've looked at that patient, I think it's 30%. And once we receive that, we pay 31% or 15%. And that's where most of the disputes are sitting at, and we have many courts that are sitting all over the country to try to resolve that. And we believe that if we manage our pension care system well, there will be no need for courts, because we believe that we'll be relying mostly on our case managers that will be going around there checking on our patients so that we can do away with disputes. So that is the system side of the issues. Now, what we're saying is that this is not our brain. It's not going to do the job itself. Otherwise, we'll be inviting problems. What we're basically saying is that you need to improve the people. You need to have the requisite skills in your organization to be able to manage this environment. What we're basically saying is that we're redesigning the organizational structure to fit with the current modeling that we're coming up with. What caliber of people are you looking for? What skills are you looking for? In the finance area, as I've indicated, that we've come up with an interim structure, which we have fully implemented. We're now looking at the entire organization as a second phase to say, in the medical area, what skills, how many doctors do we need, how many nurses must we employ, what are the kind of skills. So those are the areas that we're focusing on now to determine the right structure for us to be able to manage that. And also, the current people that we have in the organization, we need to do a skills audit to say what gaps do they have given the future that we're going into, so that we can train them to be able to fit into the new future. So that's the skills audit that is currently being done to be able to determine that. The other issue is improving governance. I think the challenge that we've not had in the past was that governance was absolutely non-existent in the compensation fund. Policies were sitting in people's heads. One could not pick up a set of policies that I could be referred to say, in the finance area, these are the policies that govern our environment. In the medical claims area, these are the policies. Policies were written as and when officials think that they want to manage a particular environment, and they'll just give an instruction to officials to say, today you manage it this way. And we believe that it's not proper. And I think also what we believe is that we need to also focus on funding levels, because I'm quite uncomfortable about the current funding level. We're sitting at around 120% funding level. And my own research with the two mutuals, they're almost around 300 to 400% funded. And I believe that's where we should be in terms of the funding level. So those are the issues, and we believe we can address that. It's possible. If I look at the active employer database currently, we're sitting at on about 180,000 employers who are paying and we have an employer base of over 400,000 in the country. If you correct that, you will be able to improve your funding level. And we are currently paying twice more than what the medical aids are paying because of the delays. So this, the Fed has been built. So we need to reduce that. We need to be competitive and be able to pay the same rate that the medical aids are paying. And we believe once we've addressed these governance issues and we've got proper systems, we're paying on time, we'll be able to negotiate a better rate with the medical providers. So I'm indicating to you now that we are almost there. Once we have implemented the system in April, in between now and then, we are looking at roadshows for employers to begin to introduce the new approach and to tell them also about the new premium determination, the future modeling that is coming, and to try to get a buy-in. Because we believe if the employers are buying in, we will be able to go a long way in addressing these things. And also we'll be able to do away with fraud. Because one of the good things about this system, when an accident is reported and a claim has been dealt with, it sends a report on a monthly basis to the employer to say, this has been your accident situation in your employee. This is what this fund has paid out. So please remember, your premiums might rise. So if there was no accident and this is a fraudulent case, the employer will come back and say, but nobody worked for me here who was injured. I don't know who this person. So we're able to use employers also to assist us in managing fraud. So that's one of the future things that we are looking at to try to address some of the current challenges in the organization. Indeed, Honorable Nyakemba indicated that we were requested to submit the report. We will be submitting the third quarter report through the Office of the Director General to indicate step-by-step progress as to where we are with the issue that we have promised you earlier on last year to improve the compensation fund. So, honorable members, I'm foreseeing a situation whereby in 2012 we will not be talking about these things anymore. 2011, 2012 is our last financial year in terms of the turnaround plan. 2011-12 is the third year of the plan. So we will be coming back here to give you probably a closure to the story of, in the competition front.
Thank you. Who's telling this? Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and honorable members. I'll be very brief and specific to the point. I just want to make a general input first with regards to the issue raised about the portal and the definition of sheltered employment factors. I understand that the overarching goal of the present administration, and in particular to all, is to contribute towards an environment that cares for people and that contributes towards a productive economy. And therefore, the issue about the portal, it's about moving away from a system where society in general relies on handouts. That society, to the extent that there are productive opportunities for people to contribute into the economy, such opportunities must be created. That applies to the issue about the portal, and that applies to the question raised in relation to sheltered employment factors. With regards to the question about the definition, members will recall that this present administration adopted what is called an integrated national disability strategy, which, amongst other things, a range of other objectives in the strategy It's about mainstreaming people with disabilities into the open economy. It's central to that strategy to deal with myths with regards to the role of people with disabilities in society in general. Now, sheltered employment factories fill that gap with regards to providing the gendering in people with disabilities, their capabilities in the manufacturing sector. What do as sheltered employment factories? The DG has indicated that we are specializing as 12 entities located in 7 of the 9 provinces of our country, 12 entities, specializing in wood products, in steel and metal products, in textile garments. In our primary market, in the past and in the present, it's government departments, ranging from school furniture, providing you with the kind of furniture that you'd have in office departments, and providing linen to hospitals, providing garments to the hospitality industry. At top of the range skill in those factories, and top of the range quality, as the DG has indicated. Just a brief history, and perhaps for the benefit of the members, very brief. Where do these factories come from? Post the Second World War, DG, in 1949, then administration decided that people who had suffered both emotional and physical disabilities arising out of the war and who could not be mainstreamed into the open economy, the then Department of Manpower established in 1949 these entities to provide them with gainful employment. And as a result, they have existed since 1949 as entities providing employment, productive employment, if I may emphasize, because these are not workshops, these are manufacturing capabilities, productive employment to people with disabilities of all races, creed, and color. What are some of the key challenges at the moment? The DG has indicated that, and perhaps to amplify the point, that part of the major challenge at the moment with regards to those entities is that they have got the capacity to provide employment opportunities at the moment to 3,000 people with disabilities. But at the moment, they are providing employment only to 1,050 people with disabilities. As a result of the withdrawal of what government calls the preferential procurement status of the factory, because there's an ownership dimension that with regards to the preferential procurement status, these factories could not meet. As a result, that reduced the number of employees from 3,000 to 1,000. So the potential exists with an increase with regards to government contracts that we can employ more people, up to 3,000 people. Now, the strategy moving forward, to answer the question that one of the honorable members has raised, the strategy moving forward is that at the moment, these entities had operated since inception on the basis of a memorandum of understanding, and therefore essentially meaning that they do not have their own legal persona or legal identity. As a result, the Department of Labor has provided funding through the Treasury for the development of a business case, the first phase of that process. That is to look at international, doing an international analysis, looking at people with disabilities internally, has been completed. We're now proceeding with the second phase of the project, which entails conferring to those factories a legal entity and therefore conferring to them a status of a trading entity. That's the second phase of the project, which means that they would be able to trade like the rest of the other companies in the private sector. That's the second phase of the project. The project entails the following: increasing levels of employment for people with disabilities in the sheltered employment factories, and therefore increasing your current intake from 1,000 to to 3,000 people. The second strategy entails, and perhaps the member of the committee raised this question, that you would provide a center of excellence in those sectors where you pilot a range of projects where you train people with disabilities, and therefore providing what is defined as a repository for people from the sheltered employment sectors being mainstreamed into the open market, which means that companies in the private sector who are unable to meet their quotas at the moment could go into the sheltered employment sectors, be able to source people trained from those sectors for the private sector. The third element of the strategy, Chair, is that we would increase, as I indicated, employment opportunities and therefore restore dignity of people with disabilities with regards to the fact that they can also make a contribution to society in their productive capacities. The third element of the strategy, Chair, which is currently being investigated in the sectors, relates to collaboration between these sectors and the compensation fund. And there's quite an interesting aspect about it with regards to a country called Algeria. In Algeria, and I'll come back to just very briefly to indicate the potential that exists. In Algeria, there are factories of people with disabilities, where those factories manufacture processes. People would have artificial limbs, etc. You go directly to those factories, and you get your processes from those factories. But the preferred supplier, which is paid by the state, is those factories. Which means that in our own environment, the South African environment, where it's extremely difficult for working people to source processes, for example, your wheelchairs, etc., sheltered employment factories, with changes in the legislation with regards to the compensation fund, could become, in the long run, a preferred supplier for people who may be compensated by the compensation fund, but who may also require processes with regards to wheelchairs, etc. So there's a huge potential that needs to be tapped out with regards to people with disabilities throughout the country. So that's briefly, Chairperson and members of the committee, the status of the sheltered employment factories at the moment. Once again, to extend the invitation that the DG has made to members of the committee with regards to you visiting the factories. You've got some of the best practices with regards to the production layout, production processes in some of the factories that are more or less exactly the same as that you would find in the private sector, unprecedented elsewhere in the world. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Now, how many more people?
Yeah.
Yeah. That including yourself, or there are two excluding?
Yeah, two, then I'll just
say. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. There are certain conditions that the claimants must satisfy before they can get the UIF, but the ones that are relevant to the discussion at hand is the first one that will say they must register as a work seeker. Already you know that you have somebody who's looking for a job. The second one is that you must be available for work and you must also be able to do the work. So when the DG refers to the issue of the portal, what we are going to do is that we are going to register these people into the database and then we are going to help them to get jobs. But we're not going to infringe on their rights because we are going to match the skills that they have with the job that is available. So that is the value that we are going to add as the UIF. And the benefit is that we are going to preserve their benefits because if they are claiming without going back to work, they exhaust their benefits. I think it is in that light that we are actually trying to add value in this regard. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will just deal with two, three issues. The one was the issue around the legislative amendments. Now, there's no way that we can bypass the committee. We will bring the draft bills to the committee. The process is that after the minister has looked at it, he's satisfied with it, he will then take it to cabinet. and we will then have a further consultation process with NEDLAC on the actual bills now itself, but also the bills will come to Parliament, and you are would be able to engage also on those bills, even amend them if you so feel, but that is the process that we will have to follow. There was a second issue around the small businesses and employment equity. We are not bypassing that. The process is ongoing of looking at compliance with employment equity. As you know, the law requires that small businesses report every 2 years on the first working day of October. So that process is a continuous process. On the Industrial Policy Action Plan and Green Jobs, we are participating in the economic sectors and employment cluster where the issue is being discussed. The lead department for this is the Department for Environment, and we are going to be part of a working group or task team that would further elaborate on the Green Jobs Initiative and to also look at the Green Jobs Initiative in the context of climate change and the outcome of the Copenhagen Summit. The last issue was the issue of decent work. I think Honorable Duma raised that issue. Decent work has got four pillars: the issue of employment, the issue of social dialogue. Social dialogue is that people are able to collectively bargain at the workplace, access to social protection and social security, that they have access to unemployment benefits, to compensation in the event of injuries and so on, and also rights at work, where people have freedom of expression and association, where they can join trade unions, where they can form trade unions, and so on. So those are the issues, the four pillars covering a decent work, and of course a lot of these are already contained in the Bill of Rights of our Constitution, where people have the right to strike, where they have the right to fair labor practices, and so on. So work needs to be measured whether people have access to all of those issues outlined within the four pillars of the decent work agenda. Thank you, Chair.
I think before the DG, I will allow the members to say something. Do you want to say something?
Yes, Chair. Oh. My mind is still on
Yes, sir. I think one area of concern to me, I understand the process of the bills. And in the briefing, it's three legislations, so LRA, Basic Code BCA, and EA. But within the LRA, I understand that there are certain sections that need to be looked at. I think in the strategic workshop that we had, there's a number of sections that we spoke about. Your self-determination in the cleaning industries and other industries. Okay. But however, those processes are not necessarily supposed to come to us. It's the competence of the minister in relation to self-determination. But a point was raised in that process to say, I think we need to be critical as to how these self-determinations are processed. Yes. That was one point. The second point was the I know it might not necessarily be an issue that is within the bills that are talking about even now. The other issue that we raised there was the fact that remember around the issue of CCMA, I know there was a debate where the you envisaged that. Should an applicant not present himself or herself in a CCMA, whether it's a bargaining council or what, for conciliation, then now the commissioner must have authority to dismiss the case. And I think then the issue was because we're basing our argument on the judgment on the judgment where you said, no, there's a judgment also that came later to say, no. Yes, you still have a right to dismiss the case if the applicant didn't appear. So you still owe us that. I think lastly, sir, now, let me confirm myself in the presentation and the questions that were raised. These questions were not necessarily brought to this labor legislation because we understand the sections in Basic Constitutional Employment Act, in EA, as the DG outlined earlier. I'm not sure whether to say it's a cooling period if an employer has not submitted the report. Is it? But the critical issue, the critical bill here, which questions were based on, is on labor broking. Why? Because there was an exercise that we marked on as the portfolio committee, which I think if then you will draft a bill without even hearing as to what are the results of the public hearings that we went to, then it will be incorrect. I think that's the issue. If then you can clarify us on that issue, I think with other bills in other legislation, Madam Chair, I understand those processes. But critically, it's this one.
Thank you. Maron Pulas?
I should think, Mr. Skadden, you know what you didn't respond on. The interpretation of the clause by clause of the sectoral determination is fundamental to us. I should think you will come to that, because if any sectoral determination is without that, then the determination of the minister is like, we will want him one day to go and become a casual and feel how it is to earn 50 cents a day. And without any guarantee of ours, I should think our law is too open at the moment. A casual is a casual, but the definition of casual forever, 30 years, we are you retired. So if that is not corrected, I should think it's a problem. But on the last one is the to regulate the labor market on your purpose, which I was waiting that it will come out, but it didn't. The purpose of regulating labor market, I should think, take to what Mr. Nyakemba just said now. Honorable Nyakemba said, how you regulate? What are the regulations are you talking about? Because on the LRA, or any Basic Condition of Employment Act, or anyone, there's nothing talking about the labor broker. So we don't know what is the purpose of regulating the labor market. If you still believe that anybody who's operating in the labor broker sector is regulated, there's no law protecting those workers. It is not true what the employers to establish the labor brokerage are using to say this is, they are using temporary employment as selling modern slavery to people, selling our people to the other big guys. So what I'm saying is that when that is done, I should think, just qualifying what Mr. Ngembo was saying, we need to understand what is it that you are regulating on the labor brokerage, because there has never been any law protecting those workers who are being sold. And we can be interested to hear how you're going to protect those workers now. Without telling us about the legislation, they are not protected now. What you have done, the inspection. Did the inspection take place to ensure that those workers are working within the laws? And if not, what enforcement did you put on place to ensure that that doesn't happen, those the workers are not abused? Because I have read everyone, I don't find anything about labor brokerage or that, what is it, the way of selling people. It's not on any law or any legislation unless you tell us differently. But what I expected is from the inspectors to say we have even investigated and check and find that this law is not regulated anywhere. The defaulters, what you're going to do with them, A, B, C, D, because it's nowhere. that temporary, then if anybody had employed people based on that temporary work till such time something has been done, it must be based solely on the temporary work. And that was supposed to be investigated by the inspectors, because that is a big issue, that we are allowing slavery in this country. Thank you very much.
Okay, let me take it from that side, Honorable Shelley.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to come back on the very same issue that I raised the Tucson Center. I don't know whether I was understood or misunderstood by Madam here, because when you gave your explanation, you spoke about a center that's in Soweto, and you are thinking of establishing one in Maponya Mall. I don't know the story around it, but around the country we've got 139 Tucson centers, and the sole purpose of the establishment of those Tucson centers were to bring services to rural communities or to communities around. Let me just make an example around my area. A Tucson center services around 20 villages that come to that center, and if the services of Department of Labor are given once a week, I mean, it's not a problem, but one Tucson center will service maybe about 20 villages. And here you on your spread you say you have about 20 mobile centers in remote areas. If you add the 20 and the 72, it's plus or minus 90, and we will still have around 47, or plus or minus 47 to 50, Tucson centers who do not have the services of the Department of Labor. My inquiry was to find out what are your plans to go about, so that in all the Tucson centers, because the primary objective of having these Tucson centers were to bring services to the people and to realize some of the principles in Batupin. So mine is just to give us an indication of when are you going to be giving all your services to all the Tucson centers, because our primary objective is so that you, in all these 139 Tucson centers, the services of Department of Labor are there, and if need be, if they are once a week, it's not a problem, or twice a week, but when they should be in all those centers.
Honorable Law.
Thank you.
Having listened to the explanation on sheltered employment for people with disabilities, I think in concept, sounds like a very brilliant idea. But it's well and good to hear how well this thing was defined, how well it was studied, probably researched, and it's another thing to put it in practice. I need to say this. I think in principle I buy into the idea. It sounds very glary, it sounds very nice. I fail, however, to understand, because I'm sitting with exactly the same situation that the speaker have just mentioned, sir, I can't remember your name, that in situations where government, in instances where a school has to be supplied desks where children are sitting on, these particular people, or this particular body, a similar body to this one in a province of the Northern Cape, who actually, and I think I don't want to go into that explanation because you've done it well, I fail to understand why, because it's a government institution, we had to see to it that we support these type of initiatives, and which I completely agree with. But the particular tenders went to private people eventually, who never even delivered the goods. Yet, people of this nature could have done, and I don't doubt that, I haven't seen the caliber of work that they're doing, I would love to visit these centers myself. I don't doubt the efficiency and the standard of work that they produce. Everybody knows that. It's all over around the country. But they were never being utilized. Millions and millions of tenders were given to private people, which, again, defrauded government, if I have to use that word, because the things were never delivered. And yet, we're sitting with people who can do that, and at the same time, we're capacitating our own people, which at the end of the day can be resourced
into the mainstream of the economy at the end of the day. I would have loved to see a situation where we actually promote something like that. And I cannot agree more with you than what you said already earlier on. Chairperson, let me just get to my notes. Labour broking. We have done the public hearings on labour broking. And yes, I agree, we need to see how the final product is going to look like. But I also just need to remind or to refer my colleagues on an article that was published on Sunday, past Sunday. Unfortunately, it was published in an Afrikaans newspaper. And it had to do with the labor broking that took place in Namibia. And if we want to see what the outcome of that was, the ruling basically that was made on that issue was, Namibia also have gone that route, and they knew what the consequences was. And I would advise my colleagues to go and read the article in that report newspaper. And if needs be, I will do the interpretation for you. I will rewrite it over for you in English. Just to see exactly what was meant or what transpired. And yet, we are embarking on the labor broking issue, the banning thereof, or whatever we want to call it. I would advise my fellow colleagues to rethink and to go and reread that article. It's in Afrikaans. If you can't find it, I will get it to you. If you give me time, I will translate it to you. Thank you, Chair.
Are you? I don't know who are your colleagues. Is it the members of parliament, or we are talking to the department, or to everybody?
Parliament. Yes, I'm referring to the to everybody around here.
Oh, okay. Honorable Nyakemba.
Sir, I think let's go to the purpose of this meeting. I think it's important. We might miss the point. The purpose of the meeting for the department to come here was to brief us. What is it out of the state of the nation address are they going to put in place? Now, there are bills that we were told about. The question here is, it's not about what do you do, what is the judgment of the Supreme Court in Namibia. I've got the judgment. I don't have the article. I've got the entire judgment. It's a big document like this. So the point I'm raising here is that what I was raising was that out of the briefing that we have received, the department has made mention of the bills, and including in those bills is the labor broking issue. My point was, there were public hearings that as the portfolio committee, excluding the department, went out there. So there are processes that are going to be in place by us. So therefore, I don't believe that it will be correct for the department to submit a bill in relation to something that we have not yet finalized as the portfolio committee. So this advice of the Sunday paper and something else, doesn't fit in any way here, because we are not discussing the end result of the public hearings. The meeting is coming on the 23rd of February, which means next week on Tuesday, for us as politicians, and say, what is it that we realized as a result of the public hearings? And then map up a way forward of how are we going to deal with that, not today. So then the articles in the Sunday newspapers will come in that meeting. So the clarity that we're seeking from the department is that out of the bills that they've spoken about, are they including the labor broking? Because my argument is, I don't think they need to include the labor program, because there's other processes that we've undertaken as the portfolio committee, which there are still other processes that we need to follow before there can be a bill.
I'm going to allow few, not more than 2 hands, because we have a limitation of time, and some people are going to be talking for the third time.
So I'm not going to allow people to have broken toys. Ma, you're small. You talk for a long time. Can I cut you? I don't know what is short. It's how many seconds?
No, you cut me if you think I'm long.
Just straight to the point. Okay.
No, no. On this public employment, I mean public works employment. I've seen there where you are saying you've got an agreement with the mayors to give you the data of how many people are unemployed in their district or whatever. I just want to check, why are you not talking with them not to to outsource? Instead of outsourcing, absorb those people into the municipality as workers, like you take the water reading meters are outsourced. Why don't you employ those people? And those people are not even counting because the contract belongs to certain individuals amongst us. Thank you.
Thank you. You are very good. Honorable Lemadisha. Lendo, No, but you can talk.
No, just to check, Chair. When he started at the small point to give his response, the head of UIF there, to quote him exactly, he said, if you don't have a skilled capacity in a particular section, forget about it. I suppose the chair remembers that. Now, what does mean?
Are you saying the chair remembers? The chair remembers what you have just said.
Oh, you may not remember.
No, sorry. I don't.
Okay.
Okay.
No, that's right. Yeah. What does that mean, through your chair, that as a sequel to the absence of skill in that area, the necessity and demand in that section disappears? That's one thing that I need to understand. But following what Mr. Nondwangu was talking about, I'm making a follow-up to two areas which I know we spoke about with the Department of Labor, but I've not seen any movement altogether. Those who were workers in 2000 will remember that they made a contribution to the law, to the Labor Job Creation Trust, which I know goes more than 100 million now. And the government was supposed to make contributions, et cetera, et cetera. I will not go into that. But in that those meetings, we said that the government must contribute, but they haven't. Now, I can tell you that over the past 2 weeks, I know that that fund has interacted with some retailers, job was a thing, Woolworths, Pick and Pay, made contributions, and are going to save 1,400 jobs. But in what sense? In the sense that they have agreed that the materials will no longer come from India, will never come anymore from China, but the workers in South Africa will be given a chance to produce those, and only the children's garments, etc., will be sold in Pick and Pay in Woolworths. But then I don't hear all together. And remember, if that material comes, it then assists, it means a whole lot of workers will be able to work, not only that 1,400 here in the factories in the Western Cape, etc. Now, I would want to say to the department, please, can we look into that so that we are able to move forward? And lastly, Chair, I raise this, and again, I don't hear any movement, where I said, and I think this is coming up, Chair, through your chair, the DG, that employment does not only, employers are not just coming, but are recruiting foreigners into our industry. But then the other round happens where the employers will move their factories from one province to the other. Example, in the industries where they produce the clothing and so on and so on, in the Western Cape here, for instance, when workers make legitimate demands, these employers will move from here, for example, to Durban. And this has been happening a lot, where exploitation will happen there. And when workers make those demands, these employers will move from Durban to Botswana. It's happening throughout. Now, I would propose that we do a lot there, so that when we go on to talk about the, amendments, et cetera, we try to find a way that that is truly looked into. This movement of employers just to exploit the working people and avoid, the production in the country, to stop India, to stop this thing, China, et cetera, et cetera. Can you look into that, please?
Thank you. Yeah, time to talk. Okay. Honorable, the Kennedy. I don't know about that. The first one to
talk.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Yeah, since the core business of government is service delivery, and service delivery itself depends on a variety of skills. And here we have a sentence that says the filling of vacancies will be done within 6 months of the post being vacant. I would like to know which skills is the department looking for, and what guarantee do we have that within 6 months we shall have acquired the relevant skills? Because in the past we had a post that was vacant longer than anticipated, and the reason being you were having difficulties in getting the relevant skills, or maybe the inability to attract, to recruit the relevant skills. So this 6 months, is it too ambitious, or what informs this? Is it not too ambitious? How realistic is this 6 months?
Let me just start. This is the last round. You see, I really don't know why we should get into details of what is that we should do and what is that we should not do on this labor broking issue, or why are we preempting it? You know, I think Honorable Nyangema has just said the program is saying on the 23rd we'll be coming back as a committee and decide on the report that will be tabled in Parliament on this issue. And whether the judgment in Namibia or anywhere else in the world is saying contrary to what we would agree on as the committee, that will not be a sin or an offense, because the reason why you are studying other cases, you want to study other cases or go to other countries and hear what is that they have done on issues, but at the end of the day, you are going to do what we think as South Africans will be suitable for us. We are not going to apply things that have been done in other countries qualify or other organizations dogmatically. We are going to use our own experiences and do what we think is good for South Africans. You know, there's a question that you did not answer, members of the department. That question is important to me. The question that says, what constitutes a decent job? When you say decent job, what is that people should get? What are we talking about when we're talking about decent job? I'm asking that question because you know, on this State of the Nation address and what is in the ANC manifesto, what the ruling party has promised people in terms of decent jobs and decent work. I have no doubt that under labor brokers, there is no decent job. There is no, you can't talk of labor brokers and talk of decent jobs. It's a myth. I'm talking about labor brokers as a system, not individual, but as a system. So it is important for us to know what is this decent jobs and decent work. What does it mean, decent job or decent work? What does it mean? So that when we deal with this process or when we embark on the process of providing decent jobs to people, we know exactly what is that we're talking about. We don't, all of us here in the room, we know exactly what is a decent job. And when we're talking about decent jobs, people who are affected, it's the category DG that you have mentioned in your opening remarks, the mine workers. You can't talk of decent jobs under mine workers. Security. Decent jobs include a number of things, but I want you to tell us, mine workers, your hospitality workers or workers in the entertainment industry, your farm workers, your domestic workers, in those categories and the others, construction workers, you can name them, all those workers, it's very difficult to talk about decent jobs. And all the category of workers that I've mentioned, you know how most of them are employed. So, I think it's too early for us to raise our tempers and our emotions on the question of labor broking, because that time will come. And when that time will come, definitely what happened yesterday in the gallery, not going to be the same. In the chambers of parliament, where the ANC president was under attack by the opposition parties. Personal attack. It was not attack on the State of the Nation address, but it was personal attack on the president himself. In any case, we know we didn't expect any they've never wanted Zuma from the beginning. But on this issue of labor broking, when it's being discussed there, we're going to turn tables around. I know it's going to be on the press tomorrow, take it to the press, but that's what is going to happen. We will fight for the workers of this country.
Well, of order, Chair. I thought you are not chairing as chairperson, you are supposed to be neutral in this instance. Number one, you said you are...
Magister, you are out of order.
Okay. But that's what the chairman is out of order.
No, you should have lift up your hands, Magister. I know the name that I'm raising is the name that is irritating you. But this is what I'm saying, because you have allowed people to bring a topic which is not supposed to be brought here today. You didn't raise a point of order. Now, let's talk about the multi-purpose portal members of the department. It's a good initiative. But I think it's important to understand at what stage would you switch the tap off. The tap must not just be switched off. We should understand at what stage so that what you have said here, it's not distorted outside there. Explain to us what you mean by switching the tap off. The Auditor General's report, I will appeal to the department just before they submit. At some stage, I think you need to come to the committee and tell us how far have you gone in terms of addressing the issues that have been raised, and how far have you gone to make sure that issues of that nature or any other issues will not be the issue in your next report, and so that we are not taken by surprise. If there are issues that you know that you cannot deal with them, or issues that are going to make your report to be qualified, we should know in advance. It's really embarrassing, but at least now you have a DG. You have your turnaround strategies. You have employed new people. We understand. We are not expecting you to come here next year or end of the year when you are coming with your reports and tell us you are still in the process. You know, we've been listening to this process of employing new people. I'm even surprised that you have not yet employed the inspectors that we are expecting to see. The question of inspectors, we dealt with it, I think, in a number of meetings. Now, we are talking of quality and salaries. I just hope that those qualities, maybe you must tell us the qualities. When you talk about quality, are you referring to qualifications? What is that you expect? What is this quality? When we talk of an inspector who is characterized as a quality inspector, what is that you expect to find from that inspector? Is it a question of academic qualifications, or other things are included? What is it? And in the provinces, how is this thing going to be unleashed? Your vehicles, your uniforms, and take into account that you have various provinces. How much vehicles? Is it going to be starting in one province, where you'll give them uniform and vehicles, or is it something that you are ready to just unleash in all the provinces? How is it going to start? It's a good thing, and I think that's what you want to see. We don't want inspectors that are going to be chased by farm workers again. We want inspectors that are going to go there, who are going to fight for workers. Inspectors that are going to be respected by any employer. Inspectors that are going to have teeth. We've said this, we are repeating this thing. That because your inspectors, as they are toothless. So we need a type of an inspector that will enforce the legislations of labor in every company, starting from parliament to the government, everywhere. There should be no place that is no go areas for the inspectors of labor. So at least if we can hear, when is this good thing going to happen? Is it now? Is it in the next financial year? Are you ready to start in Gauteng? Exactly when? These two song centers. Do you have your members of the department that are based there? I know most of them that they are not as effective as you would want them to be. But what I want to know from the Department of Labor, do you have your people who are stationed in those centers? How do you service those centers as department? Do you have your people that are there? Because I don't think that some of the roles that you, some of the questions that people will want to know from the Department of Labor, they can be outsourced to other people. Do you have people, are you intending to have people who are going to be assisting? Because if we can have people of the Department of Labor in those two centers, some of the questions that are given to us or given to members of parliament, if we know that in all these two centers there are people who are from the department or they know where to be directed, it will be easy. Your inspectors and Tucson centers and MENA, it will be so easy for us. The system, pension fund system, this thing is so complicated to me. Just tell us how different. I know that you'll be using, you are no longer going to use your files, your manual files, your boxes. But then, how are you going to be able to trace or to know that if somebody says, I worked for a certain company and the company that does not exist anymore, a company that has been liquidated, how are you going to deal with cases where you can't have records at all? And these boxes of invoices, where do you keep them? Do you have a place where you keep all these boxes? What is the scenario about these boxes? Because my worry is, are you going to use the same people that we're using to feed the systems that you have put in place? What are you going to do with the staff that was dealing with the invoices? And what is happening now with the new staff? Or you have changed the people we're using, we're working manually and trained them to do the work electronically. What is happening to those people? Thank you.
Chair, is it possible to ask for a 5-minute comfort break?
5 minutes. Okay, it must be 5 minutes. Thank you. No, but they say it's 5 minutes. 5 minutes will start. He has to speak, I can't say no.
No, I want to go to the point with the new number.
I'm not going to be able to do that. You don't know your question. It's not that pretty and you.
Arrangements.
that are out there. But just to ensure that we're all working from the same slate and all of that, they're all allowed in all our meetings. So there's a free flow of information. No one is, there's no hidden anything from anybody. They're free to participate, they're free to, and this has been formalized as a circular that we have sent out to all the unions. I wrote to all their secretary generals to deploy their members appropriately. So we think, Chair, that we have opened up the doors for a lot of engagement with the unions. And the question also around the issue of forecast to smaller employers, I think, Chair, the key thing that we operate with as a department is impact. Given the limited resources that we work with, we have to work strategically with the limited resources that we have. Yes, indeed, smaller employers have got to be a focus. But, Chair, if we were to deploy all our resources to small employers, the impact would be very minimal. It's important to understand for us, Chair, that we want to impact to as many workers as possible with our laws. So if we get the big guns to do the right thing, because they employ a vast number of people, it's the same amount of time it takes to go to a shop owner that employs three people. It's the same amount of effort that you do to even a large employer. So in terms of ensuring that we've got efficiencies in the work that we do, we want our labor activity, our labor service to go a long way. So we do focus on large employers largely, and we think that that also has got its own effect of ensuring that even the small employers get to line, because they see that the big ones are shaping up. But we have not lost focus on the small ones. We are focusing on them, but the big one, the big focus is really on the big employers, because we want impact. And also, Chair, I must point out also that in terms of Employment Equity Act, some of the compliance laws were very strict about what is called a designated employer, that not everybody called an employer has to comply with Chapter 3 of the Employment Equity Act, which requires you to submit a report, et cetera, et cetera, because we're trying as a department to ensure that we're sensitive to not overburdening smaller employers. So all of these things are really taken into account. In terms of the two song centers, I think the response that we gave, Chair, maybe it was not articulated to the satisfaction of the members, but I think the issue here is that the question originally was, what informs the 72? And the answer was, I think it's important to first of all understand that the two song centers did not find us folding arms. The two song centers found us in operation. We have, as we speak, 125 labor centers. The two song centers, what informs the 72 is that we then say, where is it that we don't have a labor center as a starting point? And then we then say, okay, two song center comes in here. So that's the first line of response to this, that the two song centers, we see them as closing gaps where labor centers are not present. That's the first thing. Secondly, our mobile centers, it's not correct to create a one-on-one relationship in terms of one labor center and so on, as if it's one region. When we say something is mobile, it's a one-to-many relationship. The fact that one truck can go to this area, and that truck can go to another area, and so on. So when we've got 20 trucks, it doesn't mean 20 areas. It means we've got 20 trucks, but they can go maybe to 60 areas, as it were. It's a one-to-many relationship. Hence, they are called mobile. They have that flexibility. Labor broking. I think the Chair has been correct in terms of saying the processes that we take, the notes from the Honourable Member there, that there's a parliamentary process. In fact, Chair, this is the only point we're making here, is that we wanted to demonstrate to the committee here that we're not sitting folding arms as a department. We're not sitting here and folding arms. We have to do what we've got to do, get employed and paid to do our work. So we've done what we can do. And if you check, Chair, on the parliamentary or cabinet processes, one of the things that we had said we would have done as a department is that we would have done the bill by January and we have not done that. And that's precisely because the minister has been very clear that there is no conclusion of work by the department that will happen outside the parliamentary process. And we had to not observe that January deadline from the department because that deadline did not factor in the parliamentary process. So the minister has been very clear and emphatic that the work is not done up until parliament opens, up until parliament gives a report on the work that it's been doing on this matter. So the point we're making is that from our side, we've done what we can and we're ready. We didn't want a situation where the parliamentary process comes and they find us totally disorganized, not having done anything on our own. So we've done work in preparation, and we hope that we've taken care of a whole range of things, and that if the parliamentary process comes, first tries is that it must have minimal impact on what we've already done. So that point is taken on board, Chair. Mayors, I think the issue of providing mayors with information, we are of the view that information is power. And therefore, as to what mayors do with the information that they give them is their call. What we are trying to respond to here, Chair, is that we want to ensure that there's integration in government. When we've got local government doing a whole range of things, if we have a particular set of information that local government can use for their own planning purposes, for determining a whole range of things that they want to determine, we have, what point we're making here is that we have capacity to assist them with their planning with information that we can gather and give to them. So then can decide if they want to know how many houses they need to build, how many industries they need, etc., etc. It's their call how they use the information, but the point is we're going to have information, we're going to make it available to them. How they use it is their call. 6 months, too ambitious, and so on. In terms of vacancies, I think the point we're making here, Chair, is that in the past, even with skills available, somehow there's been some kind of lethargy in the system where there is no acceptable reason why a particular vacancy is not filled. Jobs get advertised, everything gets done, but for some reason in the system there's some lethargy. So what we're trying to say here is to set a performance standard where that with everything being equal, we should not go beyond 6 months filling in a position. What that means is that we're going to have to work smarter. For instance, before you shortlist people, before you bring them to interviews, as an example, you do the near thing. By the time you interview them, you already know whether they've got clearance or not. So that once you make a decision after that interview, you are able within a couple of days to send them letters of appointment, as opposed to working everything one after the other instead of doing other processes in parallel. So I think the essence of the issue here is that we're going to work smarter. What is a quality inspector? I think, Chair, we are the Department of Labor, and therefore we have to respect our laws. We should be the first ones to respect our laws. We have, in the Employment Equity Act, a definition of a suitably qualified person, which brings into effect four key areas. One is formal qualification. Two is prior learning. Three is previous experience. Four is potential to rise to the occasion in a reasonable time. All of those will be brought into bear in deciding a quality inspector. No one of these conditions on their own will really be sufficient to say you're a quality inspector. You must have a combination of these things. So we want to make sure that we've got people that are appropriately ready to be able to do the right thing. Multi-purpose portal, I think my colleagues here have in different ways tried to explain that we work within a government that has said its defining feature will be delivered. And therefore, we in support of that broad vision, we are saying that clearly we are not going to encourage a situation where we legislate laziness. We are not going to legislate laziness, Chair. But at the same time, we are very mindful of the apartheid past that we come from, a situation where some will be told that there's a job for you in the Eastern Cape and in Gauteng. And if you say you are unable to take it, then close the tap. Clearly, we are not going to be doing those kinds of ridiculous things. We are very, very sensitive to all of these things. And because we're working with Labour on all our meetings and so on, it's going to be a very consultative process all the way. Everybody will know that we mean business, we need to deliver, and everybody, all individuals in this country, must make a commitment to do things differently, must make a commitment to be part of the productive economy. So it is in that spirit that we're doing this, but there's no way that will reenact apartheid issues. Sticky issues that cannot be resolved and so on. Chair, we think that we've got a very clear program of action in terms of correcting a whole range of issues. I can't think of any particular issue that cannot be corrected. In the compensation fund, the only challenge will really be the teething problems in the implementation of the systems, because what we've done there is that we are merging two systems. We're merging the Siemens systems with the Rand Mutual systems. So to the extent that those two systems are able to work together, that would be the issue. What we've also done in terms of, for instance, the boxes, people versus electronic people, there is a parallel process of retraining people to ensure that they're up to speed in terms of the new IT infrastructure that we're introducing. So we're not checking out anybody, as it were. So there are two things that we do. Because the CF right now, in the new way, in the new turnaround strategy, part of the elements of that is to decentralize it so that it's closer to the people. So some of the people will be taken to the provinces, and the unions have been fully consulted on this. They'll go to the provinces, but there'll be training that goes as part of the package of bringing in the new IT system. So people will be brought up to speed to be able to deliver. Yes, indeed, Chair, we do have people in the Tusong centres. We do have labour people in the Tusong centres. We treat the Tusong centre as some kind of a labour centre. As I said, Chair, these Tusong centres, they close gaps from where we are. So, yeah, I think in fact, in some instances, you sometimes find, because Tusong centres found us in operation, in certain instances, you find that there's too much close proximity between a labour centre and a Tusong centre. So you do find those kinds of issues as well in the process. Yeah, Chair, I think, and then the other questions that came earlier, for instance, from the Honourable Member there, what does representativity mean? And people, the minority group, he said, of 1994, how do we deal with that? I think a short answer to that, Chair, is that Employment Equity Act is very clear in terms of what representativity means. In this country, 74% of people are Africans nationally. 10% is colored, 12% is white people, 3% is Indian. The law requires equitable representation. Those are the kinds of targets that we should seek to achieve at all levels in the economy of this country. So when we've achieved that, we shall have achieved representativity. As to what the honourable member refers to as minority groups, 1994 and so on, we're implementing the law as it is. And at this point, as we speak now, the point made by the honourable member is not in the law. So it will be illegal to factor that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. We have come to the end of the meeting. Your presentations and the discussions that followed the presentations, I think, were fruitful.
After the budget vote of the minister, I'm sure we'll be talking about deadlines as to when are we finishing that. When are we? That's what we'll be talking about. We'll just call you for deadlines. Thank you. You can go.
All of us.
You must say that the chair, this consultation with the union of a flyer or a letter is not what we understand. I want to say that things will be possible next time. So next time maybe we'll have a